WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking about unemployment and, oh, those so crazy Republicans. Also, Elizabeth Wydra from the Constitutional Accountability Center. She's going to be here. Rachel Eckhoff from the Sierra Club talking about the insane job-killing Bush-era trade agreement we're talking about with South Korea. So much more. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So right off the bat, our Republican friends, the right, they're all tingly in the panties. They finally found a judge, a Bush-appointed judge, mind you, that has come up with some bogus reason to shoot down the individual mandate, to shoot down personal responsibility. And I got to be honest, I'm still struggling with this. Lately, the conservatives have got me baffled. I used to know. I used to have a pretty solid feeling where the conservative ideology was, where their worldview was. Lately, not so much. You know, this healthcare thing, to me, I understand you're being against big government. I get that. But the whole personal responsibility thing, not getting it. The WikiLeaks thing, completely not getting it. The right is supposed to be in favor of oversight and accountability, and they're the government reformers and the people who are the watchdogs. Where are they? Fiscal reform, fiscal responsibility, yet they want to hand out hundreds of billions to the very wealthiest. Again, that we have to borrow. Remember that. We have to borrow this money. It's not sitting in a pot somewhere. We got to borrow it. So not getting it there either. So the right, really, to me, they're lost. They're wandering in the woods. And I wish someone could explain it to me why these are conservative principles. Why handing out hundreds of billions to the wealthy who don't need it at a time when the country's in crisis and the debt is looming over our head. Why that's conservative policy. Not getting it. Absolutely not getting it. But it's about putting money in their pocket, isn't it? And for me, that's what it comes back to. It's not about ideology anymore. It's about who can get what, how much can they fill their coffers, how much money can they put in their pockets. And if you saw the ruling yesterday, Virginia Republican Attorney General Ken, help me here, Susanelli, close
yes.
enough?
Yes, close.
Close enough. Like Corbett, he filed a lawsuit against making sure people are personally responsible and responsible for themselves. And they found U.S. District Judge Henry Hudson, who agreed with him, said, you're right, the Commerce Clause shouldn't be used to require citizens to purchase services like health care. And they found a guy, and they're all, woohoo, yay! You may remember, Virginia passed a law blocking personal responsibility in the entire state. So they've decided, you know what, we're not into that. Trying to figure that out again. Help me if you can. 1-888-520-RICK. Two other federal judges, as you remember, the last couple of months have come forward, one in Virginia, interestingly enough, one Michigan. They've said the health insurance mandate's just fine. Just fine. Anyway, today Republicans are all tingly in the panties, as I said, especially as they prepare to take control of the House of Representatives, where they plan to force the big government showdown and continue the Republican Party platform, which is, as it has been, No. The White House, of course, defended the constitutionality of the insurance mandate and has announced that, obviously, it will appeal. And what's interesting is there are a bunch of people who are saying, you know what, it's probably going to hold up. It's probably not going to hold up under appeal. They'll probably pitch this one out. There is another lawsuit pending in Florida in front of District Judge Roy Vinson, another Republican appointee. So be prepared to have a 2-2 tie as they move to the next level. And that, I understand, should be heard on Thursday. Who knows when that decision will be rendered. But again, they're going to probably take a look at this one and see where they can tweak it into the future. I got to be honest, this has been a well-litigated case. There have been 20 separate lawsuits filed against the legislation. And federal judges have dismissed 14 of them, at least two. You know, we got the two that ruled that it is constitutional, one that's not. So there are three more outstanding. And what I found interesting is the guy from Michigan, Judge Steele. He's in his decision back in October. He wrote, "There is a rational basis to conclude that in the aggregate, decisions to forego insurance coverage in preference of attempting to pay for health care out of pocket, drives up the cost of insurance. The cost of caring for the uninsured who prove unable to pay are shifting the health care providers to the insured population, the higher form of premiums, to governments and to taxpayers. The decision whether to purchase insurance or attempt to pay for health care out of pocket is plainly economic." So he's saying, look, it is part of the commerce. It is part of the economics of the country. And it's something that we have to maintain. Look, if you choose not to get health coverage, if you decide, you know what, I'm not going to buy it. I can afford it, but I'm not going to because I'm healthy. I'm 25, 30 years old, never been sick a day in my life. Never needed a doctor. Why should I start now? But you choose, you know what, I'm not going to do it. And you fall out of fall off the toilet in the bathtub, hit your head in the sink, you need 15 stitches, you got broken bones, couple of that stuff. You go to the emergency room, you rack up about a $5,000-$6,000 bill. You don't have it. You don't have the money. So what happens? Well, they write it off because you can't pay it. And they'll send collections after you, and they will hound you until the day you die because there's a whole industry at hounding people. They'll ruin your credit. You'll never be able to buy a house. You know, interest rates you'll pay through the nose for. But that's a whole other story. They'll just write it off. And people who were responsible, who do have health insurance, they're going to have to pick up the bill because they're going to have to pay higher to cover the losses. That's just basic economics. And that's how we all get stuck with people who choose not to be responsible. Now, look, there's some folks who are broke. They don't have the money. And this is where the government has stepped in and said, look, we will help provide coverage, but everybody has to have it. Everybody. It's that simple. To me, it's simple stuff. But I saw today dying to get under from underneath their campaign rhetoric. You had Eric Cantor, Republican for Virginia, wanting the Supreme Court to, you know, to hurry up and jump in. He said, quote, "To ensure the expedited process moving forward, I call on President Obama and Attorney General Holder to join Attorney General Cicilli in requesting that the case be sent directly to the Supreme Court." You know why? Simple. They don't want to have to put this up for a vote. They don't want the American people to see which side of this they're on. They don't want this to be an issue going forward. It was great in the campaign. Got everybody all riled up, got them all, you know, fired up inside. But they don't want to have to actually go and fight this. So they want to make sure that the Supreme Court steps in because they think maybe they got a shot. Personally, I'm not so sure. Orrin Hatch, he had to chime in. Who, mind you, back in the 90s, Orrin Hatch was right on board with personal responsibility, right on board with the individual mandate that they wanted to put into the Hillary plan. He was right there, but today he's out on the other side. Today's a great day for liberty, he says. Congress must obey the Constitution rather than make it up as we go along. Liberty requires limits on government, and today those limits have been upheld. Yet again, back in the 90s, he was on board, man. He was right there. Right there. But today, you know, because the sea change has happened. Maybe not so much. So it's kind of interesting. This decision is kind of interesting to me. Because, again, I go back to this whole discussion. I go back to this whole debate we had for almost a year on health care, and I go, we needed a public option at the minimum. I would have preferred Medicare for all, and I've said that 1,000 times. Because had we gone here, I think, I think this wouldn't be a problem then. Because Hudson's decision is, there's kind of an interesting sentence that caught my eye. He writes, neither the Supreme Court nor any federal circuit court of appeals has extended Commerce Clause powers to compel an individual to involuntarily enter into the stream of commerce by purchasing a commodity in the private market. So my question is, if we had the public option, which is not a part of the private market, if we had Medicare for all, how would he have ruled? It's an interesting question. We're going to bring this up a little bit later. But some legal scholars are wondering about his decision. And Brian Butler writes, federal judge Henry Hudson at the Richmond Court, Virginia, 2010, the Virginia Federal District Court judge who ruled that the individual mandate in the health care bill is unconstitutional is catching a lot of flack. And not just for having financial interests in an anti-healthcare reform consulting firm. Oh, did I mention that? That he had a little problem?
No, I was about to, but you hit it on the head. He should have accused himself, actually.
Was that a problem?
You know, I think so.
Uh-oh. But here's the thing. You know, legal experts are really, they're attacking him on the merits of his decision instead. Citing an elementary logical flaw at the heart of his opinion. This is what Brian Butler writes. And that has conservative scholars, even ones who may be sympathetic to the idea that the mandate is unconstitutional, prepared to see Hudson's decision pitched. A guy named Orrin Kerr, he's a professor at the Georgetown University School of Law. He's on a pretty regular, I guess a generally conservative blog place. He wrote, I've had a chance to read Judge Hudson's opinion, and it seems to me to have obvious, fairly obvious and quite significant error. The key portion that he points to is this, where Hudson writes, if a person's decision not to purchase health insurance at a particular point in time does not constitute the type of economic activity subject to regulation under the Commerce Clause, then logically an attempt to enforce such a provision under the necessary and proper clause is equally offensive to the Constitution. So he's saying that it's not economic activity that would be regulated under the Commerce Clause. So the federal government, he's saying, has no right to regulate insurance companies, and again, I'm not figuring this out because it's 20% of our GDP, or going to be. I'm not getting it. But as Kerr writes, it's all wrong. The Necessary and Proper Clause allows Congress to take steps beyond what the Constitution enumerates. So what's all written out there, what I love my constitutional scholars who are working at McDonald's, what I love them telling me, is without the Constitution, it's right there. It's all written out, word for word, bang, bang, bang. That's it. That's all they can do. They can do nothing else. And then you bring up these couple of things, the Commerce Clause, the Necessary and Proper Clause, the General Welfare Clause, those kind of things. And, again, it's not written in the Constitution. It doesn't apply. And I find that interesting because there is so much more. I mean, you look at Social Security, you look at Medicare, you look at a lot of the things that we take for granted today. If you were to apply this standard that Hudson has laid out, none of that stuff would be constitutional.
That's why those on the other side have already said that. There are just huge precedents. If it's going to be decided on whether or not it's been done in this country, it has been done on a huge scale.
A number of times. And the part that gets me again is, look, you can be against it, and I understand being against it. But I don't understand this doing an about-face on your principles of personal responsibility. To me, that's one of those things that no conservative has been able to explain to me. I'm just not getting it. Why I should have to pay for you as a free rider. I'm just not getting it. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on this? We're right back after this.
Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard is applauding a win at the World Trade Organization for U.S. tariffs on Chinese tires. The WTO found for the United States in the trade dispute with China. Girard says since President Obama put the tariffs on in September of 2009, U.S. tire production and capital investments in U.S. tire production are up, and new jobs have been created for American tire workers. GM is making moves to further reduce its workforce of skilled trade workers. The company is offering $60,000 to workers who are willing to leave their jobs or retire by March of 2011. The offer is being made in 14 of GM's U.S. plants. The move comes before the United Auto Workers and the company begin contract talks in 2011. AFSCME's DC-37 local in New York City is urging action on a bill that could put 1,000 laid-off workers at Off-Track Bedding Corporation back to work. Wanda Williams, political director for DC-37, says Republicans in the state Senate are blocking legislation the company needs to reorganize and keep operating in a bankruptcy. Williams says the Republican blocking action is hurting not only these workers, but the state budget because it deprives the state of hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue.
We urge the Republicans to break from their leaders' misguided position and do what's right on behalf of the state of New York, the racing industry, the New York state economy, and these 1,000 workers.
Williams says Republican obstructionism on this OTB bill in New York puts another 40,000 racing-related jobs at risk. DC-37 says the votes are there if the Republicans would stop blocking the legislation. Williams says it's not too late for the state Senate in New York to still act on this bill.
We don't believe time has run out. We have the votes to be able to get this bill passed, and we're asking for the Republicans to understand that this is about the racing industry in the state.
Even as he continues to threaten to slash 900 state employee jobs, Governor David Patterson tried to portray himself as the workers' champion Monday while he signed in new wage protection laws in New York. Jesse Russell reports.
A study by the National Employment Law Project said that in New York City alone, employers illegally withhold $1 billion in wages from low-wage workers per year. New York's outgoing governor, David Patterson, signed into law the Wage Theft Prevention Act, which will provide additional protections for those workers. Workers who are shortchanged by their employers can claim 100% of wages as damages in courts, an increase from 25%. Employers can also see fines of $5,000 and up to 1 year in prison. The law will go into effect in 120 days. The New York Department of Labor has been one of the leading fighters for wage recovery in recent years. In 2009, the department boasted collecting a record $28.8 million in illegally withheld wages.
This newscast made possible by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. You got something on your mind, question, comment. If this healthcare thing doesn't make sense to you, or if it does and you can explain it to me, I'd love to hear you. Our stat of the day comes from the Too Much Online blog. It says the White House tax cut agreement, according to Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley and seven of his Democratic colleagues, they put out a statement last week that, quote, would require American taxpayers to borrow over $50 billion in order to give, on average, $100,000 in additional annual tax cuts to people earning over $1 million per year. These bonus tax cuts sit on top of the $43,000 per year that our millionaire friends will receive in tax cuts on their first $1 million of income. And I got to tell you, I'm so glad that our conservatives are in office. I'm so glad we have those fiscal conservatives who are so concerned with our national debt. You know, I remember for years on this program, pretty much during the entire Bush administration, I was screaming about the debt, and Jake, you can attest to that. In fact, we had a debt counter on our website for the longest time, and I kept telling you, you know, this eventually it's going to come due, and it's going to come due at a bad time. Well, we're getting to there. All those years that Bush and Cheney were handing out billions and trillions to their cronies, we were struggling, and they could care less. So I find it interesting that now, now what we have is people who tell us that they're so fiscally conservative, but show us that they're full of, well, it's a good thing most of them have brown eyes. Let me just leave it at that. Our attorney general friend from Virginia, he's pretty much been everywhere today. He was on CBS News claiming that the Affordable Care Act, I don't know if you saw this, it must be unconstitutional. Has to be, according to him. Has to be unconstitutional for the same reason that it would be unconstitutional if the federal government said every citizen has to buy a gun. He says, never before in our history has the federal government ordered Americans to buy a product under the guise of regulating commerce. Imagine, he says, if this bill were that in order to protect our communities and our homeland security, every American had to buy a gun. Can you imagine the reaction across the country? Well, the truth of the matter is the same legal power is at stake in ordering us to buy health insurance. I don't know, the gun thing, I think...
I think there is a place in Georgia. Remember that a couple years ago?
Yeah, but I think the right would be overjoyed. They'd be all tingly in the panties.
I believe there was a township that... Okay, you're getting to that. Okay.
But for... there'd be one or two that would be... They'd be behind that, don't you think? I think, on the right, anyway. Our friend Ian Millhiser, he writes this. Our attorney general friend there in Virginia, his comparison between health care and guns is unfortunate, since it reveals his utter ignorance of American legal history. Indeed, Ian writes, rather than trying to imagine what the reaction to such a hypothetical law might be, our Republican friend from Virginia might learn exactly what America's reaction was to an actual law simply by picking up a history book. As it turns out, Ian points out, President George Washington signed a law that was almost identical to the one our friend from Virginia railed against on CBS. And he provided a law which reads, every citizen so enrolled and notified shall within 6 months thereafter provide himself with a good musket or firelock, a sufficient bayonet and belt, two spare flints, and a knapsack, a pouch with a box therein to contain not less than 24 cartridges, suited to bore his musket or firelock, each cartridge to contain a proper quantity of powder and ball, or with a good rifle, knapsack, shot pouch, and powder horn, 20 balls suited to bore of his rifle, and a quarter pound of powder, and shall appear so armed, accounted and provided, when called out to exercise or into service, except that when called out on company days to exercise only, he may appear without his knapsack. Sadly, Ian writes, our friend from Virginia failed to understand that And truth of the matter is he's failed to understand a bunch of things. His original brief, our friend from Virginia, challenging the Affordable Care Act, was riddled with legal errors, including, as Ian points out, an embarrassing claim that the Boston Tea Party somehow rendered health care reform unconstitutional. And, you know, I got to be honest, I had to call a couple of my gun friends who did know about this. I had thought that it was a requirement. I didn't know that it was a law. I thought it was one of those things that, and it shows my ignorance, although I wouldn't come out and say that, like our friend from Virginia did, that it all just without having checked into it. But I did know that it, you know, every man was supposed to have a gun in order to be in the militia.
Yes.
Because we were never supposed to have a standing army, so they said every man has to have these things. And I didn't realize it was actually a passed law. I thought it was just one of those things it was. But they actually went through and passed it, so that's pretty interesting.
Well, we had in theory, we had a standing militia because the truth is we were a young country and probably couldn't afford a standing army. And there's the reluctance. We just fought for our freedom against the most powerful army in the world, and we were a little reluctant to put all that power in the hands of the government at that time.
Yeah, that and the fact that, you know, people seemed, once you have a big army or you spend all this resource on the army, there's A, a need to justify the expense, mm-hmm. and B, you need to have some feeling that you're getting worth of your money, so you gotta start doing things, which I gotta be honest, I understand. I completely understand, but that's interesting. Interesting point right there. You know what's going on? A lot of states are struggling right now. And we're going to have this conversation over the next several months because Pennsylvania is in a pretty big hole as well. But Arizona is one of those states at the top of the heap. They're basically doing what we're going to start doing in a couple of months. They're having this massive fire sale. They're selling off their courthouses. They're selling off office buildings. Well, actually, they're not selling them. They're doing this... The other dumb thing that we do, we lease them. So they're going to give us a whole bunch of money up front, or this is what they're doing there. But we're going to do it here. Trust me, it's coming. They lease them off for 75 years, and then you pay them rent every year for 75 years. And in the long run, it's going to cost the state almost double, the state of Arizona, almost double what they're getting back. So nice job. Nice job. But they're looking to balance their budget sheets. And who are they looking to balance it on? The people who can least afford them. And you may remember last week we talked about a woman who, Jan Brewer, decided she didn't need to live anymore. No longer will the state of Arizona pay for transplants under Medicaid. So, you know, this woman, a fairly young woman, died because she couldn't get a transplant. And, you know, again, you know, our friend there in Arizona, the nice Republican governor, she's looking to gut the Medicaid program. So she's saying no more transplants for anyone and basically ignoring all pleas from anyone, Democratic lawmakers, the patients themselves. And what is she gaining by this? She's gaining about $1.4 million. $1.4 million, which comes to 0.1% of Arizona's shortfall. 0.1%. But, you know, we got to do it. You know, times are tough. We can't give out, you know, those Cadillac health care plans, that Cadillac treatment. An organ, in Ms. Brewer's mind, an organ transplant to save someone's life is part of that Cadillac health care. You know, the Cadillac treatment that you get, Jake, you know, that thing that saves your life. I got to wonder, when you had your head cut off there, when they did that roto-rooting of your neck, I wonder, mm-hmm. under her ideology, would that be a Cadillac plan?
Probably.
We'd have to ask her. But, you know, here's the thing. Someone went and asked her, Sarah Smith, who is a Washington correspondent with Britain's Channel 4 News. We can't get anyone in this country. It's like Greg Palast, who I absolutely love. The guy can't work in this country because we don't do investigative journalism. So this woman, Sarah Smith, who is from Britain, she goes up to Jan Brewer at a function and says, hey, How many people have to die before you'll reverse your position? How many people? Just tell us. How many people do you think? Well, you know, Brewer said, oh, that's unfair. And, you know, if, and this is, here's the money shot. If people are so worried about transplant patients, then they should ask the federal government in Washington to send us more money. The obvious is cold, callous. That's the obvious. But the thing that isn't obvious is that's exactly what this health care bill does. I mean, this health care bill is, that's the point. It's to help pay for it. In fact, it's going to pay 100% of the Medicaid expansion until 2016, and then 90% of that up to 2020. But you never hear that. And I find it interesting that, you know, while she's the, you know, one of those T-twizzlers out there on the forefront saying, we need to get rid of it, repeal, repeal, it would help people in her state. I mean, that's what frustrates me, that there's an avenue for help for these folks. And these ideologues absolutely refuse to help others. That's what gets, and then they call themselves Christians. That's the part that drives me nuts. I mean, look, if you don't want to take it for yourself, that's one thing. But don't deny somebody else an opportunity to live just because you got a bug up your backside.
You quoted, what, 1.4 million?
1.4 million for the transplant part of it. 0.1%.
Per operation.
Well, 0.1% of their, just their shortfall, not their budget, just how much they're short. That's how little it is. I mean, I don't think that it's worth. I don't think it's worth all of that.
Doesn't sound excessive to me.
But you know, here she is. Here she is. You know, the T Twizzler champion, saying, "Well, we need to get repeal, repeal." When it could help her people. These are the kind of people we don't need in the governor's mansions. People like her, people like Palin. These are the folks we don't need. We need people who understand governing. That's what we need. Let's take a quick break. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
One thing is clear from November's election results. Those new tea-infused Republican lawmakers are going to end business as usual in Congress. As incoming Senator Rand Paul so plainly put it, we've come to take our government back. Ah, yes, a government of the people, at last. But as one corporate lobbyist said of the fresh-faced newcomers, as soon as they get here, we need to co-opt them. Well, that didn't take long. Just days after their election, even before they had been assigned office space in the Capitol, dozens of these so-called citizen legislators were holding lobbyist-sponsored fundraisers at various swank watering holes around Washington. They glad-handed and grinned as such special interests as ExxonMobil, Delta Airlines, and Wall Street bankers welcomed them by slipping thousands of dollars into each of their pockets. Adam Kinzinger of Illinois was one. Back home, he was pledging to change Washington. Only 2 weeks after winning a House seat, however, Washington was changing him. He held a debt retirement breakfast at the Capitol Hill Club, gleefully greeting corporate influence peddlers who paid up to $5,000 each to curry favor with him. Exchanging winks, the lobbyists knew that business as usual was alive and well. Then there's Andy Harris of Maryland, a doctor who won a House seat on November 4th by denouncing Obamacare as socialized medicine. But 6 days later, Andy was in Washington asking, "Where's mine?" At a briefing for newcomers, Harris was incredulous to learn that the socialized health coverage that Congress critters get wouldn't kick in until 4 weeks after he took the oath of office. This is Jim Hightower saying, "Tell me again how this bunch is so different." They're not even in office yet, and they're already playing the insider game like old pros. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, starting this Saturday at noon, we will be living in the giant parking lot, 255 South Spring Garden Street there in Carlisle, taking non-perishable food donations to help the local food bank. So if you've got a couple of cans, maybe a case or two of non-perishable food items you want to drop off at our truck, we will be there. The ABF trailer, and I want to thank our friends at ABF for donating a trailer for our use for the week of the food drive. Very nice of them. But we'll be there with the big trailer. There'll be signs all around telling you exactly what it is. So good times, I think. I'm worried that we're going to be a bit frigid. We're going to be a bit cold there, Jake.
Gee, I wouldn't know why, just because they predict it's going to be zero tonight, wind chill.
A balmy zero.
You better have about 10 blankets for that baby.
Yeah, well that, you know, hey, it's called suffering. And if you want to join us in our winter wonderland vacation, only $25 a night, we've got several boxes right there for your accommodation. We, of course, deluxe accommodation for all of our guests, along with gourmet meals. Maybe I'll throw a bagel and a hot dog together or something.
Well, you know, we joke about 10 blankets, but you and I both know there's a lady right down the street here from where we broadcast every night. She sleeps out on the sidewalk in her little tent every night. She's done that for a long time. That's the reality of their life.
That is. And that's why we're doing this. And that's why we're asking you if you want to come along. It will give you the idea and it'll give you the a little bit of experience. Now, here's the thing. I can play homeless all I want. The reality is I know at the end of the week on Friday, Christmas Eve at noon, I'm going home to my family. The homeless people that we will meet, and we will meet several, they will not. And that's the reason that, you know, this is a start. And as I've said for the last couple of years, last couple of times we've done this, our goal is to make sure that everyone has a place to stay at night and something to eat every day. And we, as a community, as a society, we should never rest until that is a reality. Because after all, this is still the wealthiest country in the world. No one should go hungry or homeless. That is, going back to the politics of things, that is unless we have Republicans running things. And yes, I'm going to say that because, you know, they seem to be the party of the rich. They don't really care about the underclass. And I look at Mitt Romney, who may be our next president. He may be. Who knows? I hear a lot of talk, a lot of excitement around him. An article today by Evan Santoro. Mitt Romney has a solution to America's unemployment problem. Rather than keeping Americans government help, rather than giving Americans government help when they lose their jobs, help which he says keeps them unemployed, Romney suggests workers pay for their own unemployment insurance. And the government, on the other hand, should spend its money spurring companies into making new jobs. So taxpayer dollars go to corporations. Unemployed workers, well, you know, screw you. But here's the thing, Mitzi. Pennsylvanian workers, people right here in Pennsylvania, they pay their own unemployment compensation. So I'm not quite sure what you're getting at. I'm sure what you're getting at is that it would be limited and that it could never be extended. I'm pretty sure that's it. Evan goes on to say, as part of a sharply worded attack on the Bush tax cut extension compromise, published today's USA Today, Romney states his case that the extended unemployment insurance contained in the compromise will keep those out of work from looking for new jobs. In its place, Romney suggests individual unemployment savings accounts over which employees would exercise direct control when they lose their jobs. Does that sound familiar to you? I'm getting kind of a ring of familiarity. The article goes on to say Romney doesn't detail how his plan would work. Well, gee, you think he would? Come on, they never do. But suggests it would be similar to, oh, I don't know, the health savings account. Ah, now I'm starting to get it. Basically another shelter for the very wealthy to throw a bunch of money that they're never going to have to. I'm getting you there, Mitzi. I'm getting it. The article goes on to say that personal savings accounts aren't the only solution that Mitzi offers to solve the unemployment and rest. No, he's got others. The other option, he writes, is putting in place financial incentives for employers to hire and train the long-term unemployed. Again, Mitzi doesn't offer any details, but the phrase suggests government spending aimed at corporations. So to summarize, Mitzi's plan to fix unemployment includes workers spending their own money and government spending the workers' money to help corporations. I'm starting to get this. I'm kind of getting this. This guy could be president, which is kind of scary to me.
Well, I mean, we're kidding ourselves if we don't think this is part of his strategy. The truth is, he's perceived as a little bit to the left of some of the other candidates. I mean, he still has that. For Republicans, it's an albatross that he dared institute a government-controlled healthcare system. Government initiated, at the very least, in Massachusetts. And to some Republicans, that is akin to, you know, pretty much eliminating yourself as a presidential candidate. And he's moving to the right on a whole slew of issues. It's all about him being elected president.
And again, it's this rightward issue, this rightward mean that somehow the people who are on unemployment are lazy and shiftless. That if given the opportunity to work, they still wouldn't. Which is ludicrous, because I've, you know, doing this program, I've met a number of people who have been long-term unemployed, looking for work for a long time, for the 2 years since the Bush recession started. And they're out there diligently, putting out applications, sending out resumes, at the library all the time, putting out resumes online. And you ask them, do you get any response? And the answer is no. And their answer to all of this stuff, their answer to all of this is to put the burden on those least able to support the weight. Look, there are five people, and this is just on average, five people looking for every one job that's out there. So even if every single job opening in the newspaper were full, there was no, you'd open the paper tomorrow, there would be no more classified ads. You'd still have four people unemployed for everyone that got a job. What do you do with those folks? And now, look, had Mitzi come out and said, look, you know, I'm not in favor of handing out money. We should find things for these folks to do, even if it means making government the employer of last resort. I would be on board with Mitzi. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying, hey, tough luck to you, buddy. We need to give more to the top 1%. We need to make sure that my wealthy buddies, we collect more. I mean, that's the whole gist of this article, that he's angry that the Republicans compromised. And to be honest, the compromise from the Republican side really wasn't that much of a compromise.
Oh, you know, I was thinking about that today, Rick, and think about what they got. You know, it's actually a better deal than I initially thought for the Republicans.
Oh, they got a wet dream.
Between $800 and $900 billion, tax breaks for the top 2%. Then on top of that, thanks to the president, as far as I'm concerned, punting on third down and not going to the exact end and capitulating on the inheritance tax, he allowed the Republicans to reduce it from 45 to 35%, up it from, was it 3 million, 3.5 to 5 million. Oh, and it's even better. Many of those people who avoid all the taxes are the very wealthy, and then he gave them a break on the minimum tax. Now, beyond that, you know what the Republicans are going to do. In 2 years, they're going to come back, and they're going to say, well, you know, heading into the presidential, see, those Democrats, they just can't get the deficit down.
That's the thing that drives me nuts.
And then on top of that, it's even better for them. They can say, we think that to get the economy down, you've got to give us more tax breaks again to the wealthy, because that's what we need to turn the economy around.
And the biggest
it's a win-win-win-win for them.
Well, and the biggest poison pill of all is taking that money out of Social Security. That's correct. That's the good.
I forgot about that.
That's the cherry on the top, man.
But there's even more. There's even one. The president's whole position, his supposition is: look, I understand that the Democrats are upset, and yes, they shouldn't have these tax breaks. But if we don't do it, we're going to induce a lot of suffering. Well, you know what? If you throw $800 to $900 billion on top of the current deficit, it's going to preclude a recovery quicker than you would if you didn't have it. And what does that mean? That means more suffering for more people.
I'm not against borrowing $800 billion, as long as you use it the right way. You know, as I've talked about before, there are right ways of borrowing money, and then there are these ways, the wrong way. I mean, to me, you spend $800 billion, you want to put a train across the country, you want to build infrastructure, I think that's good. But to hand to the wealthiest people in the hopes that maybe, possibly, oh, please, would you create just one job?
Well, what you're saying is if it's for the right reasons, but it's not. So what does that mean? That not only means in the near future, perhaps longer than that, we're not going to have enough money for the right reasons.
Exactly. And that's, again, what the Republicans want.
And I really don't think that this administration thought this through. The more I think about it, the more I'm absolutely firm this is the wrong way to go.
I was against it right from the beginning. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make it happen!
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome to the new God gate.
Dark Ages. You know, the thought that you may not be living right, I never really thought of before, but you look at all the things that are going on, all the ways to keep an eye on you, all of the stuff on the internet that, you know, you put out there, people know about you, you walk down the street, you're being videotaped, OnStar in your car, no matter where you go, someone knows your GPS in your phone, they know where you are. They know. But you always thought, you know, hey, you know, the people out there might not be insane, or at least hopefully they're not. Which brings me to newly elected Representative Alan West, who thought it'd be a good idea at one point to name his chief of staff some right-wing talk show host. Now, that, when I think politics and I think, you know, the mechanics of government and moving legislation through the body of Congress, The first thing I think of is a loudmouth talk show host. I don't know why anybody would find that odd, that you wouldn't want, you know, some big mouth on the radio running your operation. But that was what Mr. West did. There was a call, there was a big hue and cry. So then he asked her, you know, to leave, and she did. Because I don't think she really wanted to do the job anyway after she found out she probably wouldn't be able to keep her program. So, you know, again, found her way down the aisle. But this WikiLeaks thing has really caught the attention of some very strange people. Mike Huckabee, for instance, wants the WikiLeaks guy killed. Wants him killed. You know, that's the good Christian thing to do, obviously. Trader Joe Lieberman wants it shut down by any means possible, and he wants the Justice Department to investigate anybody who reported on it. A lot of government agencies are telling people, hey, you can't read that stuff. You know, the workers can't read it. You could lose your job if you read all that stuff. Well, Mr. West, he was on a right-wing internet radio program recently where he condemned the WikiLeaks guy. And he had this to say, which I, wow.
And I think that we also should be censoring the American news agencies which enabled him to be able to do this, and then also supporting him and applauding him for the efforts. So that's kind of aiding and abetting of a serious crime.
We should censor the agencies who reported. We should censor the American news agencies who reported on this. Am I the only one who's scared to hell? Am I the only one who's quaking in my boots from this guy actually being in the United States House of Representatives? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I mean, does this not scare the bejesus out of you? Well, you've got a guy who's saying, you know what? We should be censoring those newspapers. You remember the newspapers? The only profession in this country constitutionally protected? This guy actually has the audacity or the ignorance, I don't know how you want to put it, to say we should be censoring newspapers.
He's only talking about the cornerstone of our democracy, the First Amendment. That's all. But why should that, I mean, seriously, why should that surprise you, Rick, from a right-wing Republican? I mean, they've been consistent the whole Bush administration. How many times has the Bush administration...
No. They were not consistent. If they were consistent, they would have been up in arms about the outing of Valerie
Plame. No. They were consistently silent, is my point. They were consistent. They didn't seem to care when they outed Valerie Plame. How about the FISA laws and the Patriot Act? Where were they? Deathly silent. Where were they?
Insane. And, you know, I look at the country of Iceland, and this week a report came out that they're looking at giving MasterCard and Visa the boot over censoring WikiLeaks, over the fact that, you know, people in their country had given them money, and then, well, you know, sorry, you can't do that. So the country's actually considering, they're having a serious review of the operating license of Visa and MasterCard in Iceland. Now, trust me, it's not going to happen. There's too much money there. But the mere fact that they came out and said, hey, look, we got a problem with this. Here in the United States, nobody seemed to have a problem with it, except the folks who were hacking into their system and slowing them down. So I had to wait in line at the gas station. And that's how we Americans think of this stuff. We internalize it. I was inconvenienced.
Isn't that the truth?
You know, because I did. They had to run my card like 5 or 6 times. And the guy's looking at me with a kind of a crooked eye going, this bum can't pay his gas bill, and now I'm stuck. And finally it went through. But, you know, at the time I was thinking, wow, I wonder what happened. Now I know that they hacked into their system, slowed everything down. But I was inconvenienced. How dare they? That's how we think. You know, in countries like Iceland, they don't tread on censorship or on freedom of association or on any of those things that we used to, I guess, that we take for granted, that we used to value. I mean, we used to value our freedom of speech. We used to value the ability to associate with people, but evidently that's kind of changed.
And they're not only governments, Rick, but they're companies that consistently have tread on internationally recognized human rights. The International Human Rights Day, which was last week, when we celebrated that Human Rights Day, the International Labor Rights Forum, the ILRF, has come out with a list of about five companies nationwide. And dishonorably, three of those companies are situated here in the United States. First and foremost, R.J. Reynolds Tobacco. The executives of the nation's second largest tobacco company continue to refuse to meet with workers to discuss working conditions. The Farm Labor Organizing Committee reports that the tobacco workers suffer from racism, harassment, lethal pesticides, nicotine poisoning, and lack of labor and human rights, as well as poverty. Although R.J. Reynolds does not hire its workers directly, it has the clout to change the terms under which laborers work, directly impacting their living and working conditions. R.J. Reynolds cigarettes, which, by the way, are in boycott from the AFL-CIO boycott list for my international, the BCTGM. So don't buy R.J. Reynolds tobacco products. You can help these workers out. Another honoree, Del Monte Produce, it moved its port operations from Camden, New Jersey, to Gloucester, New Jersey. We talked about that several weeks ago, Rick, earlier this year, saying goodbye to a 22-year relationship with the longshoreman, Local 1291, leaving about 200 workers without jobs. And last but not least, Chiquita. Cincinnati-based Chiquita subsidiary in Guatemala, which is known for human rights and violence against labor leaders, has been using a combination of threats and intimidation to repress its banana farm workers for years. The ILRF says, in fact, the Guatemala banana unions say that Chiquita has used blackmail dating back to 2003. Since 2007, 43, and I repeat this, 43 union members and its leaders have been killed in Guatemala for their union activity, according to the ITUC. So, shamefully, some of the worst offenders of basic human rights and labor rights are companies' headquarters right here in the United States.
Well, at Chiquita Banana, the Chiquita guy was on Undercover Boss, and I got to be honest, I'm tired of it. The whole storyline never changes. But I was hoping that he would go to Guatemala, the guy who's the CEO of Chiquita. Mm-hmm. I was hoping that he would go to some of those places. Because what's interesting to me is how quickly governments and corporations have married together. I mean, and going back to this credit card thing with Visa and MasterCard, it's amazing to me. You can still pay for porn. You can still give money to the Ku Klux Klan. You can even give money to the Westboro Baptist Church. But you cannot give money to somebody who put some documents up on a website. He didn't leak them. Now, remember this. This is what gets me. He's not the guy who leaked the documents. He's the guy that got them and said, well, let's put them up on the website so people can see what their government's doing. But I'm telling you, we should be very, very fearful of these big, big corporations and when governments come together with them. Just scary stuff. Scary stuff. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Rachel Eckhoff. She's an associate with the Sierra Club. We're talking about free trade. This South Korean free trade agreement, I got to tell you, bad stuff. It's another job-killing Bush-era trade agreement. Not good for you and me. Good for the top. Good for the financiers. Good for the wealthy. Just not for you and me. We're right back after this.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard is applauding a win at the World Trade Organization for U.S. tariffs on Chinese tires. The WTO found for the United States in the trade dispute with China. Girard says since President Obama put the tariffs on in September of 2009, U.S. tire production and capital investments in U.S. tire production are up, and new jobs have been created for American tire workers. GM is making moves to further reduce its workforce of skilled trade workers. The company is offering $60,000 to workers who are willing to leave their jobs or retire by March of 2011. The offer is being made in 14 of GM's U.S. plants. The move comes before the United Auto Workers and the company begin contract talks in 2011. AFSCME's DC-37 local in New York City is urging action on a bill that could put 1,000 laid-off workers at Off-Track Bedding Corporation back to work. Wanda Williams, political director for DC-37, says Republicans in the state Senate are blocking legislation the company needs to reorganize and keep operating in a bankruptcy. Williams says the Republican blocking action is hurting not only these workers, but the state budget because it deprives the state of hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue.
We urge the Republicans to break from their leaders' misguided position and do what's right on behalf of the state of New York, the racing industry, the New York state economy, and these 1,000 workers.
Williams says Republican obstructionism on this OTB bill in New York puts another 40,000 racing-related jobs at risk. DC-37 says the votes are there if the Republicans would stop blocking the legislation. Williams says it's not too late for the state Senate in New York to still act on this bill.
We don't believe time has run out. We have the votes to be able to get this bill passed, and we're asking for the Republicans to understand that this is about the racing industry in the state.
Even as he continues to threaten to slash 900 state employee jobs, Governor David Patterson tried to portray himself as the workers' champion Monday while he signed in new wage protection laws in New York. Jesse Russell reports.
A study by the National Employment Law Project said that in New York City alone, employers illegally withhold $1 billion in wages from low-wage workers per year. New York's outgoing governor, David Patterson, signed into law the Wage Theft Prevention Act, which will provide additional protections for those workers. Workers who are shortchanged by their employers can claim 100% of wages as damages in court, an increase from 25%. Employers can also see fines of $5,000 and up to 1 year in prison. The law will go into effect in 120 days. The New York Department of Labor has been one of the leading fighters for wage recovery in recent years. In 2009, the department boasted collecting a record $28.8 million in illegally withheld wages.
This newscast made possible by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, I look at these trade deals, and you hear that song, Hello Auto Workers and Steel Workers Working 40 Hours a Week. Not if these trade deals have anything to do with it. We've been outsourcing more jobs than we've been creating. You know, as my good friend Richard Levins likes to say, we've been sending good-paying union jobs out of the country, exporting good-paying union jobs and importing cheap toasters. And those toasters, not cheap anymore. But this South Korean free trade agreement, to me, has a lot of holes in it. Labor being one of them. The other being environmental, which is why I've asked Rachel Ackoff. She's the associate Washington representative with the Sierra Club. SierraClub.org is the website. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I'm looking at, you know, this trade agreement, and there's so many things that, from the labor perspective, that I am opposed to. Help me with the environmental side of this.
Yeah. Well, so for the Sierra Club, the key piece of concern for us is actually a piece of major concern for the labor movement as well, and that is the investment chapter of the U.S.-South Korea Free Trade Agreement. And the investment chapter provides foreign investors and corporations expansive rights to directly challenge public interest laws, including environmental protections, including labor protections. Corporations are allowed to sue our government for compensation before secretive trade tribunals where the public doesn't know what's going on and we don't have a seat at the table, and they bypass our domestic courts, and all if they can allege that environmental protection or a labor protection harms their corporate profits.
And we've seen this stuff before. I look at the NAFTA tribunals. And,
yeah, that's right.
And I've been calling this baby NAFTA because you know, it's not as big as that was, but it's going to be as destructive, I think.
Absolutely. Well, the key piece when we think about the U.S.-South Korea deal is that the U.S. has not had a free trade deal that included these destructive investor state provisions with a country that was a developed nation, a major capital exporter like Korea, since NAFTA. That agreement with Canada being the developed country, the major capital exporter, NAFTA was the agreement that included investor state, and Canada has been the country where the vast majority of the investor suits against our U.S. laws have come from. Since NAFTA, we haven't had a trade deal that included investor state with a developed country. The U.S.-Australia trade deal does not include these nasty investor state provisions, and there's absolutely no reason why we should have them with South Korea. South Korea has a developed court system. There's no reason we need to be giving these corporations these expansive rights.
Yeah, and walk me through a couple of them, because one that I think of with NAFTA that pops out into my head is the whole Charlie Tuna thing back in the late 90s, where we had a rule in California, and correct me if I'm wrong here, where we had a law, California passed a law that banned a certain type of fishing for tuna that would net dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
Mexico, I believe, did not. And we were sued in these secret tribunals, as I remember.
Yep. And the other, and I'd be happy to talk about specific cases. The two cases that have come up most recently are actually under the Central American Free Trade Agreement. And they've actually both been cases where corporations have been suing the government of El Salvador when the government of El Salvador was trying to protect its people from environmentally devastating mining practices. But another piece that I would mention as it, you know, really relates to working people is just the fact that the investor provisions really incentivize offshoring because it takes away the risk for investors of operating elsewhere. You know, if they know that they can go set up shop somewhere and if something gets tricky, they can just sue, then it really takes away the risk, which is a factor that might keep a company operating here in the U.S.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that I had not thought of. But at the end of this, you know, the key that I would say is, you know, again, we're taking the position of corporations over people, profit over people.
Yep.
And to me, that's a scary thing, considering that we've already got the problems we've got. Now you're going to magnify that on a global basis.
I definitely do not think it's what America needs, and I also don't think it's what President Obama promised on the campaign trail.
No, I don't either. You know, again, he voted against it. So, you know, and you're following this stuff pretty closely. What changes, because we were told there were some labor and environmental changes, what big changes came from his vote against it as a U.S. senator to now pushing it as president?
Well, there were significant effort put in by the administration to gain additional market access for auto workers.
But then they torpedoed that by going into the 35% content rule that
to me is
horrible considering the EU got a 55% content for their agreement.
Right. And one piece that's of particular concern to the Sierra Club is that in the negotiations over the autos, we actually convinced the government of South Korea to agree to let in our cars, even though they're less efficient than the standards, the new emission standards that Korea set. We're now allowed to have cars that are 19% above Korea's emission standards.
Wow.
And Sierra Club believes that you know, we need to be using our trade deals to improve environmental standards both here at home and abroad, not weaken them. So we're upset by that precedent as well.
Yeah, I agree with you, Rachel. We're here with Rachel Eckhoff. She's an associate Washington representative with the Sierra Club. SierraClub.org is the website. You know, and look, and talking about that, because I don't think we know, I don't know enough about South Korea, to be honest with you. I don't spend a lot of time studying. I wish I had the time. I wish I could. What are their emission standards? Are there, as a nation, are their standards higher than ours, lower than ours?
Yeah.
What
well,
do you
so, say? So when you think about South Korea in the context of other nations, they're right about in the middle in terms of their emission standards. So they're not, you know, the best of the bunch, and they're definitely not the worst. And the U.S., our standards are, in terms of emissions for vehicles, are lagging slightly behind Korea's standards. Again, U.S. is sort of in the middle of the pack. Not the best, not the worst. But with the agreement that was reached with South Korea, the deal would consider our U.S. vehicles imported into South Korea to be compliant if we are within 19% of Korea's standards.
Yeah, but
we're saying we can be 19% dirtier than Korea.
But we're not talking about an unlimited supply of cars. We're talking about 75,000 at the maximum.
Same amount as overall.
Okay, so we're talking a maximum of 75,000 while they're able to dump a million here. How do I get that kind of trade deal for myself?
Right.
You know, I would love to see that because, you know, and you look at all of our trade agreements. Somehow we're always at the disadvantage where I would love to say, let's turn the tables. You give me that and I'll give you what you gave us and we'll see how it all works out. Because to me, I'm looking at this agreement. We're going to lose more jobs over this. The auto workers said, oh, we're going to get 800 jobs, but good luck on that with the 35% content rule. What I see happening, and, you know, this is just my prediction here, but I do see us getting 65% content from Mexico, putting into cars saying, oh, yeah, they're U.S. made, and shipping them over, and us never really realizing those jobs that we were hoping we'd get.
Yeah. No, I too anticipate not good things from the U.S.-South Korea free trade deal. And I certainly hope that Congress will reject it.
So let me ask you this, you know, on the in the environmental part of all this, is there any language in this agreement that has environmental standards? You know, because we hear about this a lot. We hear about labor standards, you know, minimum wages, you know, maximum hour laws, those things, emissions laws, anything like that that we're not, that's not in the news?
Yeah, no, I would say that the most environmentally significant chapter in the Korea free trade deal is the investment chapter, and that's not because of the good things it does. It's because of the bad things it does. And I think that it is, it has been somewhat of a misperception that the most important chapter, hands down, for the environment is the environment chapter. Not just in Korea, but in other free trade deals, there's the idea that if we have a strong environmental chapter, you know, that'll be enough. But for the Sierra Club, our top priority is seeing major reform to the investment chapter. And until that significant reform takes place, we can't support free trade deals, even if they have strong environment chapters.
I'm right there with you. Could you take a quick call, Rachel?
Sure.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Mike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Mike?
Oh, pretty good, Rick. Hey, you know, the problem is I got a bone to pick with Sierra Club.
Uh-oh.
Because Sierra Club, and I used to be a card-carrying member of Sierra Club, but the fact is that Sierra Club has been instrumental in destroying some American industries by their opposition. And the nuclear industry is a good example. That was an industry that was indigenously American. We invented it. We built it. And now it was bought up at pennies on the dollar because of opposition in this country. And if you want a nuclear power plant today, you're going to buy it from the Koreans or the Japanese or the French or a consortium of them. But you're not getting it from an American company. And with that industry went literally thousands of American jobs.
Thanks so much for the question, Mike. What do you say to that, Rachel?
I would say that you're absolutely correct. The Sierra Club does oppose the licensing, construction, and operation of new nuclear reactors. And I would just say that we can put America to work with good, clean, green energy jobs. We can put people to work with jobs in wind and solar and weatherization and energy retrofitting and a myriad of other areas.
If only we could get started doing that.
But Sierra Club does oppose the licensing, construction, and operation of new nuclear reactors until we have adequate national and global policies to make sure that it's safe.
Let me get back to our discussion. Last question I have for you on this,
sure.
This South Korean free trade agreement. What do we do? What kind of actions are you having? What are your hopes? Are you seeing some movement in Congress to maybe block this? Thoughts?
Well, so in addition to opposing the Korea free trade agreement, we're also really looking to the first free trade deal that's being negotiated by the Obama administration itself. That's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it's a big regional free trade deal.
Right.
And because that deal is in the early stages, we're working very hard to hold the Obama administration to the standard of creating a whole new model for trade policy that protects workers and protects the environment. So we'll be working to oppose the Korea free trade deal in addition to working to create a new trade model.
So what are you seeing in Congress? I mean, do you see any movement towards blocking this, or what are you guys
yeah.
thinking is going to happen?
Yeah, well, I definitely think it remains to be seen. I think that if the administration gets too close to the upcoming election, I doubt they'll bring up the free trade deals because they're not very popular with the American people. So if they want to get it done, they'll have to get it done pretty early in the next Congress. And I definitely think it'll be incredibly close, and I think that we certainly have a good chance of defeating it.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope so.
Yeah.
Rachel Akoff, I appreciate your time. Again, sierraclub.org is the website. More information there. Again, thanks for the conversation.
Thank you so much, and thanks for the work you do.
All righty. Have a great night. We're going to take a quick break right here. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
One thing is clear from November's election results. Those new tea-infused Republican lawmakers are going to end business as usual in Congress. As incoming Senator Rand Paul so plainly put it, we've come to take our government back. Ah, yes, a government of the people, at last. But as one corporate lobbyist said of the fresh-faced newcomers, as soon as they get here, we need to co-opt them. Well, that didn't take long. Just days after their election, even before they had been assigned office space in the Capitol, dozens of these so-called citizen legislators were holding lobbyist-sponsored fundraisers at various swank watering holes around Washington. They glad-handed and grinned as such special interests as ExxonMobil, Delta Airlines, and Wall Street bankers welcomed them by slipping thousands of dollars into each of their pockets. Adam Kinzinger of Illinois was one. Back home, he was pledging to change Washington. Only 2 weeks after winning a House seat, however, Washington was changing him. He held a debt retirement breakfast at the Capitol Hill Club, gleefully greeting corporate influence peddlers who paid up to $5,000 each to curry favor with him. Exchanging winks, the lobbyist knew that business as usual was alive and well. Then there's Andy Harris of Maryland, a doctor who won a House seat on November 4th by denouncing Obamacare as socialized medicine. But 6 days later, Andy was in Washington asking, "Where's mine?"
At a briefing for newcomers, Harris was incredulous to learn that the socialized health coverage that Congress critters get wouldn't kick in until 4 weeks after he took the oath of office. This is Jim Hightower saying, tell me again how this bunch is so different? They're not even in office yet, and they're already playing the insider game like old pros.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Yes, waiting for that hammer to fall. You know, the more I look at this trade stuff, the hammer is falling on us. The Chinese are the ones who are bashing us over the head. And very few people are standing up. You know, when the steelworkers came out with a couple of charges that they've come out with, the 421 case that they brought in, the tire case, the 301 case that they brought against the green energy jobs that China's stealing, they're the ones doing this stuff. We're not getting our government. We're not getting the corporations who you would think. I mean, honestly and truthfully, I would think that the corporations who are being harmed here would be the first people saying, hey, over here, we're getting the shaft. Help us. But when the steelworkers came out with this Section 421 guard, the safeguard mechanism in the WTO provision, the tire manufacturers actually came out against it. The very tire companies who gain jobs here in the U.S., gain production right here in the U.S., they were against it. And you go, well, why, Rick? Why were these tire companies against it? Why would they be against making tires in the U.S.? Well, the reason is simple. They were the ones dumping those tires here in the U.S. They were the ones making the tires in China, dumping them here, and charging you American labor prices and pocketing the difference. This is a big scam. And you and I, we aren't in it. And some would say, Rick, why are you an Obama supporter? You're one of the guys who said Obama was a good guy. Yeah. Not on this. And I'm going to oppose him where I think he's wrong. And I think this trade deal is wrong. And much like, you know, our last guest, Rachel Ackoff, talked about, it's this part where we're protecting the investor class. You and I, we're the ones on the margin's edge. We're the one living at the margin, not the investor class. They're taken care of. They have their secret tribunals. You and I, we lose our job. We can't go to an international tribunal and say the corporation screwed us. Good luck on that. And here again, this is why I do this program. This is about people like you, people like me, working people. Those are the issues that are important. And when I look at this trade deal, yeah, while it's a little bit better than it was under Bush, it still has some of the most dangerous components. And that being one of them. And what's interesting to me is that we're not seeing our government. We're not seeing our corporations. We're not seeing those folks protecting this country. We're not seeing those folks standing up for this country. We're just not. So who does it fall to? Well, it falls to labor unions. And thank God for the steelworkers. Thank God for Leo Girard, who I just think is a great guy and one of the people who, honestly and truthfully, loves this country more than anybody I can say. And the funny thing about
he's
it is
British,
he's Canadian. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. We got folks in this country who just love these free trade agreements. But this week they announced that the World Trade Organization had settled a dispute and have favored the U.S. over China. And so the tariffs that China wanted to throw on things, no retaliatory tariffs. And in fact, the U.S. will be able to have a tariff structure in place to kind of balance out things. So good for the steelworkers. Congratulations there. If only we had more folks willing to stand up and fight this stuff back. Think about this for a second. In a four-year period, from 2004 to 2008, the domestic tire capacity in this country went down from almost 227 million tires being produced to just over 186 million tires. We completely got killed. Capacity fell by almost 96%. And we lost workers. We lost jobs, thousands of jobs. So good on them. Thanks for the steel workers. We should be doing more of it. And you know, I'm hoping that this green technology, this 301 case that they brought recently, will come to our side of things. And maybe we can start producing green energy jobs in this country like we should have been doing all along.
And to that end, there are some places in this country where that future looks pretty bright. In California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor out there, has ordered that one-third of the Golden State's energy supply must come from renewable energy by 2020. Union members and community and business leaders are working to make Imperial County, which is the county between San Diego County and Mexico, into the state's leading center for alternative energy and good-paying green jobs. They set up a job training center for IBEW members. They're coordinating with business leaders. They're going to the schools and trying to get the schools to set up, incorporate, training courses which would directly tie into the green jobs. And they're out there. They're preparing for the future. And that's exactly what we have to do. And that state especially right now, with the economic crisis that they had, they're looking for every opportunity to create jobs, and I think this is a beautiful effort. I think you're talking possibly hundreds of thousands of jobs just in one state. That's a great development.
I think it's a great thing.
IBEW, along with the sheet metal workers and a couple other major unions out there, are all tied into that. It's not just IBEW, although they're in the forefront.
Well, it is what we need to do. I mean, there is so much in this country that we should be investing in. And, you know, I was having a conversation with my chief board op over here this afternoon for lunch. And we're talking about the infrastructure in this country just crumbling under our feet. And the fact that we have failed to invest in at least 20 years. And I would make the argument we failed to invest for the last 30 years. I remember this, you know, where I grew up, you would see bridge overpasses where the trains would go over, built in 1935, and in the stone, you would see the year there. And they're still there to this day. They're crumbling. They need a lot of help, but they're still being used today. And I'm saying, you know what, now's the time to start looking at those things, saying, okay, last time we invested in infrastructure was in the 30s. Maybe it's time again. Maybe it's time to rebuild that. And instead of having those tracks that we have now, maybe we put in some more precision track that could take a magnetically levitating train that'll go 300 miles an hour or 400 miles an hour and get us across this country. And in, oh, I don't know, a matter of a day and a half, as opposed to good luck. Maybe if we decided to do some of that stuff, invest for our children, that you would keep companies here.
Well, the great thing, you know, if we have any kind of leadership in this country at all, and on a statewide level, you can't just put all the responsibility on the federal level. If you remember, was it 2 years ago, we went to that Blue-Green Conference in Pittsburgh. That was one of the best conferences, me personally, I ever attended. And what came out of that was, look, the technology is here today. The technology is here today. All we need is the commitment and money and training, and we can create as many as 4 million jobs. Just retrofitting, example after example, mayors and people in the power structure came out and testified how within their jurisdiction, within some of these cities, they've They created thousands of jobs just by retrofitting the government buildings and some of the other buildings in their community. This is not something that needs to be invented. We have the opportunity now. All it takes is will and leadership and a little bit of investment back into our country.
Well, the thing is we've had this technology. And I think, like our last caller in the last segment said, we invented nuclear technology and we let it go away. We invented the solar stuff and we let it go away. We've invented a lot of these things that, you know, we're not benefiting from. I look at solar technology and look what Germany has done with it. And it's just an amazing story. And just common sense stuff that we refuse to do because we don't believe that government should do anything. That's what we're told on a constant basis. And at some point, we're gonna pay. And I think we're at that point now where we're paying for the failures of leadership in the past generation and a half. I think we're seeing that right now. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You got something on your mind? We're right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
If you're injured at work, do you think you need an attorney? You probably don't. To protect yourself, you do need to know your rights. Retain control. Order your free book, The 7 Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case, by visiting workinjuryinpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Order your free book, The 7 Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case, by visiting workinjuryinpa.com or calling 695-4722.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, we keep hearing a lot about bipartisanship. We keep hearing, oh, why can't we work together? We keep hearing a lot of this wish and hope and dream and you know, all of this. It's not possible, folks. It's not possible that both parties are going to ever come together and sing kumbaya. It's never been that way. It's never going to be that way. They have differing ideologies. They have different viewpoints. Now, the one thing that I've always said is that I think we agree on the place we want to get to. I think we all agree on the destination. It's just which path do we take to get there? And the other part of this is one side always looks to the other and says, your path is wrong. That's the problem we're in. But it doesn't stop us from trying. It doesn't stop us from hoping, wishing, and dreaming, which is why I found it interesting. Politico had this story that the group, No Labels, kicked off its first conference Monday at New York's Columbia University with just one label largely absent. Republican. So they're having this grand unity conference, this amazing outreaching of support of people who want to become no label types and no Republicans. None. The nonpartisan initiative with the slogan, not left, not right, forward, is seeking to fill what the American people regularly tell pollsters is a vital center and non-ideological space where the commitment to getting things done is the main point. And its speakers, who ranged from Republican moderates like ex-Virginia Representative Tom Davis to liberal Democrats like New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, sang the praises of cooperation and compromise. But the only Republicans present at Columbia University's Modern Square Alfred Lerner Hall seemed to be those who had recently lost primary races, such as South Carolina Representative Bobby Douglas and Delaware Representative Mike Castle. The former Republicans like Florida Governor Charlie Crist and New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg were there as well. No senior elected Republicans were there in attendance, none of them, though a range of Democrats were present, some of them seeming to be a bit mystified by the bipartisan cast of the event, and nobody there to take the other side. So I find it interesting, and they came up with this great little, to do that they want. We are their whole little thing. They want to get 10,000 people to sign their website, nolabels.org. So they've got their declaration, which I thought we would go through a couple of the ideas for their declaration. It says, we are not labels, we are people. Wow. You're just wowing me right from the start. We care deeply about our country. Yeah, and who doesn't? We are frustrated and concerned about the tone of politics. And when in our country has that not been the case? We are passionate about addressing America's challenges. Well, I would hope so. We are Democrats, Republicans, and independents, except there seem to be no Republicans at your thing. Most importantly, we are Americans, they say. Okay, that's a good start, I guess. I'd like to have everybody involved, but you got to do what you got to do first. We believe hyper-partisanship is destroying our politics and paralyzing our ability to govern. So I kind of disagree with that. I think the lack of information of the voters, I think that has a big part of it. I think the 24-hour, 7-day-a-week news cycle that is built more on entertainment than on actual information, I think that's the problem. I don't know about partisanship, you?
Well, that might be the result of what you're describing, Rick.
Can you name a time in the history of our country where we haven't had partisanship, where we had this grand kumbaya? No. In fact, the reality is right from the very beginning of the country, we were extremely divided. The difference was we could find some compromise. That's my problem today. No, it seems to be no compromises. Except by the Obama administration, who seems to be anything but willing to stand on principle anymore. Oh, please, take all the tax cuts for the wealthy, please. They go on to say we may disagree on issues, but we do so with civility and mutual respect. Which is, okay, that's great. I'm sure those unemployed people who were going to get thrown out in the cold if we couldn't get the unemployment benefits passed, I'm sure they would care about your civility.
Well, one thing for your argument, Rick, I think I don't know what the average person thought, maybe 5-10 years ago, how the political system worked, but it's always been nasty and ugly behind the scenes. It's just that maybe some of that stuff is coming to the fore now. If you do any researching of history, you find out that politics was actually a lot worse in the early days of our country. If you read about some of the founding fathers who prior to finding out how they conducted their campaigns, we had a lot of respect for them. And on a personal, they were ruthless.
Of course they were.
I mean, there was nothing out of bounds, absolutely nothing out of bounds in those campaigns.
And the media structure was just as bad back then. The difference was it wasn't instantaneous. I mean, you had your yellow journalism back then, but it wasn't this constant drumbeat in your ear 24/7 of soundbite, soundbite, soundbite. There was actually some substance at times.
I have to say, though, in my lifetime, this is probably the most divided Congress I've ever seen in the last couple of years.
But do you think that has more to do with a divided nation? Because, you know, I seem to think that...
You might be right. It might be an effect rather than a cause.
Yeah, I mean, I seem to think that people of your generation, my grandfather's generation, they valued their paycheck first. They understood what it meant to work, that the job, the work was the place that you took care of first. Your kitchen table problems first. All these things that divide us, these societal things, that was left to another time. Economics. My grandfather's generation overwhelmingly supported the right to organize and freely associate and join and form unions and fight for collective bargaining rights. Your generation, same thing.
Well, I think some of that had to do with the Great Depression, too, because some of them people lived in the Great Depression, and when things got better, they really valued that they had a decent job. To them, that was preeminent because they knew what happened when they didn't have that job and how bad life was. So I think you're absolutely accurate on that.
But as time has gone by, we've had this great PR campaign by corporate America, and you got to give them credit. They had their plan, the Powell memo, and they executed. It was a winning game plan, and they've convinced people that there is such a thing as a benevolent corporation. And I argue that there are no benevolent corporations; there are profit seekers, and anything that stands in the way of profit will be destroyed and dealt with. Which is, you know, why I'm looking to what's going on. You got Romney, old Mitzi buddy, he wants to privatize Social Security. He wants to privatize unemployment. You got Toomey, wants to privatize Social Security. You got all these people who want to put things into the private hands. Why? For profit. Because there's big money to be made in it. The other thing you're seeing people wanting to destroy public employment. They just want to destroy any public sector employment. Because all that should be privatized and be done for profit. And I look at this guy, former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty. Actually, he's current governor, isn't he? Yeah, he's the current governor there. He's calling for the federal government to take on its unionized employees. And you got a president who, you know, had been one of the great mouthpieces for the right to organize and collective bargaining during the campaign. Never have you heard such glowing words about organizing as we heard from Barack Obama on the campaign trail. He's calling to freeze all paychecks for federal employees, which even Huckabee says doesn't amount to a hill of beans. Even Mike Huckabee. No, that's purely political, he said. Even he wants to. He understands that. So, and understand, Pawlenty is going to be a 2012 presidential candidate, we know that, but he wrote in the Wall Street Journal, "Yuck employees are making more money, receiving more generous benefits, and enjoying greater job security than the working families forced to pay for it with ever higher taxes, deficits, and debt." So he's that these people are making a living, and what he's hoping to be angry too, as I've always said, you know, if they get it, why can't I have it? Instead of, really, I mean, instead of looking at somebody and saying, you know, Jake, you had that job at Hershey all those years and you made a good living, you don't deserve it because I'm making $9 an hour and I don't have health care and I don't have a pension. So because I don't have it, you shouldn't. That seems to be what the hope is that they'll get you to go, yeah, he doesn't deserve it. Those state workers, they don't deserve it. Those policemen, they don't deserve it. Those firemen, they don't deserve it. Those soldiers, they don't deserve it. Because, of course, you know, recently we denied them a reasonable pay increase because in our good Republican mentality, well, we don't want them to get a higher raise than the private sector. Think about that for a second.
But they take it a step further. I've even heard arguments, well, you know, it's they moved companies, including my company, moved some of their jobs to Mexico because it was the high unionized wages, don't you know? And some people buy it.
But the thing is it's those wages that spurred the economy. It's those wages that grew small family-owned businesses. It's those jobs that created a Main Street. It's those jobs. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We are right back after this. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we live. Rick Smith.
I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, hungryandhomeless.org. That's the website you can go to for our food drive if you want to donate a couple of bucks to help out the hungry and homeless in our community. That's a great place to go. All donations are tax deductible. Also, starting on Saturday, this Saturday, man, it has flown up quickly. This Saturday, we're going to start noon. Our camp out, whatever you want to call it, our homelessness adventure. If you want to join us, $25 a night, get you a spot in our Winter Wonderland vacation package. $25 gets you your very own deluxe accommodations and the cardboard box of your choosing. And we'll also provide gourmet meals, some bagels, maybe some hot dogs, hamburgers, you know, something along those lines, maybe a can of cold beans. Maybe somebody will be nice and like they have been in the past. Had some folks bring me some cookies, which are very nice, not that I need them. I've had some people bring us some nice warm adult beverages. That's always nice.
Well, we've had some nice pies brought to us.
Yeah. Yes, you have.
Granny brought us some pies. God bless her.
Well, that's that. So again, this Saturday noon, the giant parking lot, 255 South Spring Garden Street in Carlisle. Come on out and say hello. If you want to argue, it's going to cost you. We expect a donation into the box. So, and I'll stand and argue all day as long as you're putting money into the box to help out the food bank. Chinese police are investigating reports that a group of people with mental disabilities have been working in slave-like conditions, according to the BBC. 11 workers, they say, were apparently sold by an unauthorized charitable organization to a factory in the country's northwest. Reporters say the workers were unpaid and lived in appalling conditions. This is not the first time a case like this has been uncovered in China, where there are no independent trade unions. Media reports suggest the workers lived in as virtual slaves. They were given no pay, no protective clothing, and had not showered for years, according to the Global Times newspaper. Apparently, they had to eat the same food that the factory's owner's dogs ate. One man said he tried to escape twice but was caught. and beaten. The workers were apparently rounded up in the county of good luck on that one by a man running what was supposed to be a charitable organization. This charitable organization then sold to the factory workers who made construction materials. According to Global Times, this guy who ran this charitable organization got about 9,000 won, or about $1,350 for each employee, and was also paid 300 won for each month that the worker worked. So, yeah, I mean, these are the people that we're trading against. This is the kind of stuff that goes on there. And the key phrase in that entire article to me was China, where there are no independent trade unions. And one of the things that I've always said is that the union movement, the labor movement, is that watchdog group, is that canary in the mine, if you will, that says, hey, things are getting bad. Workers are getting cheated. People can't make a living on the wages that are there. They're dying on the job. They're being injured. They're the folks who come together and fight for this. You know, here we would hope that this kind of stuff would never happen. But the reality is, you know, you look at China, these are the people that we're competing against. And this is some of the stuff that we have to compete against. And, you know, I always say, thank God for the labor movement in this country, or we would have none of the things that we take for granted, like minimum wage laws and maximum hour laws, overtime, weekends, vacation, sick days, holidays, you name it. That's how we got it. These things weren't just bestowed upon us by a benevolent corporate dictator. It didn't happen that way. You didn't see somebody waking up one day and going, gee, you know, my workers work very hard, and I think I'll give them sick days. That's not how it happened. In fact, how it usually happened is they'd crack the whip a little bit harder because, hey, they're good employees. We can make them work more. I can get more profit. That's the reality, folks. And again, we need to learn our history.
You're probably forgetting one, but that originated back in probably the early 19th century. Labor unions started agitating for universal education, which took a long time, but they eventually got it.
Yeah, I have a
which is really a cornerstone, very much a cornerstone to the working class.
I actually have a picture of four children with their faces. It says, "All we want is an education." It's a long way we've moved since.
It's hard to believe that there was a time in this country where very few people got a formal education.
Well, I remember I had given a speech to an education class to a school and gave a speech about organized labor, and I said, you know, looked out amongst the kids, and I said, you know, when kids were about your age, they worked in the mines, and kids younger than you, 7, 8 years old. It was their job to open and close the fire doors.
Yep.
And they would work 12, 14 hours a day. And it was cold and damp down there. And, you know, sometimes they would, you know, it's a long day. Remember, these are 6, 7-year-old kids. And they would sit down. They'd, you know, get all nice and warm. And they wouldn't hear the cart coming. And the cart would slam that door open and crush them. Because that kid, that 6, 7-year-old kid, had a 50% fatality rate. 50%. And what they did with the corpse of this broken and bloody and battered body is they threw it up on one of the coal carts. It rode up to the surface. One of the supervisors would get all ticked off and take the lifeless corpse and throw it onto a wagon where they would drive it home. And not even getting out of the wagon, they would take the body and throw it against the door. And that's how the family learned that their child, their husband, whatever, that they were home. And, you know, we talked about this over the weekend, that people don't think we can go back to some of the things that we've fought against. I had someone email me saying, well, there was never any cases of forced sterilization in the U.S. Oh, yes, there were. There absolutely were. And there were cases, numerous cases of bosses going, hey, you know what? You want to keep your job? Let me sleep with your wife. I would argue that probably goes on today, especially today. But some of the most vile stuff that you can imagine employers have done to employees.
Well, if you remember, I remember seeing the movie, the famous fire in Massachusetts, a couple hundred people died. There was a huge, very, very high case of VD among the women, where the bosses would basically, that was the price that they paid to stay working there.
Yeah.
Horrendous conditions. I mean, it almost sounds like we're making it up, but that was the reality of it.
And it's because we came together and we said no more. It's because people eventually organized and said no more. And it's going to take that again. And I think the next 2 years are going to be that opportunity to bring people together, to begin that fight once again. You know, the Tea Party, I thought at the beginning, had the right idea. They were angry. They were looking for somewhere to take their frustration out. The problem is, from the beginning, the whole movement was co-opted by corporations, by big moneyed interests, and they were following right-wing talking heads because that's what was available. There's no alternative message. There's no alternative discussion. There's no debate. The mainstream media is a corporate media. It's bought and paid for by the very wealthy corporations. Which is why I found it interesting that, you know, the Tea Party came out and said, yeah, we're mad and we're ticked off our jobs are going overseas and we're ticked off about our 401ks being chopped in half and we're ticked off that everything that we worked for is gone. We're ticked off and it's that government that did it. You go, wait a second. Did I miss something? Did I not get that memo? It was the corporations that left. It was the 1980s where they robbed your pensions. Which, if you don't think what's going on with the public sector workers isn't the rating of the 80s of the pension funds back then, you need to wake up, because that's what we're talking about here. All this privatization talk is about destroying those pension plans and denying all those people their pensions and pocketing the money. That's what it's really about. It has nothing to do with whether they care who's actually doing the job. They don't even want the job done. Truth of the matter is, it's about money. It's about how do we get Wall Street as much as we can get them? How do we get the investor class as much as we can get them? This is how. I don't know how much clearer you can put it. I don't know how much clearer. What I found interesting is I love this whole fiscal responsibility discussion that the Republicans have thrown our way. And I don't know if you remember the whole election of National Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Steele when he ran for RNC chair. He was going to have the off the hook, he was going to be the off the hook chairman. He was going to be Mr. Bling Bling. He was going to bring the brother to the hood. Problem is, he has run probably the worst RNC in history. They're deep in debt. They were completely ineffective, and they were left off on their own. Well, he said originally he wasn't going to run for a second term. Well, now I guess he's changed his mind.
And worse, he's not the most popular man in Republican circles. He's kind of hinting that, you know, if they let him go, it might be a tinge of racism involved.
You think? You think they wanted
him to be pulling the race card?
Which is interesting. I mean, because he's one of those guys who's always been out there saying the race thing doesn't exist. But what I find interesting is how irresponsible he is. And Don Todd over at the Daily Caller, a website that I'm not going to promote, he went through Steele's mortgage and found that Steele's mortgage would be around $12,600 a month with all of his taxes and everything, his first and second mortgage. He'd be paying about $12,500 a month for his mortgage, yet he was only making about $5,600 a month. So how he could be paying more than 2.5 times his salary on a mortgage, nobody quite understood. So how he's, how he's doing all these things, nobody knows. And I'm telling you, once they get in there and they find the books, I think the Republican Party's in much bigger trouble than has been reported.
You're telling me that's all he was making?
Yeah,
wow.
He makes $230,000 a year.
Okay.
Yeah. After taxes, it's about $5,600.
After tax, okay.
Just take home.
That makes more sense. Okay.
1-888-520-RICK. We're right back after this.
Until the end. Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard is applauding a win at the World Trade Organization for U.S. tariffs on Chinese tires, the WTO found for the United States in the trade dispute with China. Girard says since President Obama put the tariffs on in September of 2009, U.S. tire production and capital investments in U.S. tire production are up, and new jobs have been created for American tire workers. GM is making moves to further reduce its workforce of skilled trade workers. The company is offering $60,000 to workers who are willing to leave their jobs or retire by March of 2011. The offer is being made in 14 of GM's U.S. plants. The move comes before the United Auto Workers and the company begin contract talks in 2011. AFSCME's DC-37 local in New York City is urging action on a bill that could put 1,000 laid-off workers at Off-Track Bedding Corporation back to work. Wanda Williams, political director for DC-37, says Republicans in the state Senate are blocking legislation the company needs to reorganize and keep operating in a bankruptcy. Williams says the Republican blocking action is hurting not only these workers, but the state budget because it deprives the state of hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue.
We urge the Republicans to break from their leaders' misguided position and do what's right on behalf of the state of New York, the race and industry, the New York state economy, and these 1,000 workers.
Williams says Republican obstructionism on this OTB bill in New York puts another 40,000 racing-related jobs at risk. DC-37 says the votes are there if the Republicans would stop blocking the legislation. Williams says it's not too late for the state Senate in New York to still act on this bill.
We don't believe time has run out. We have the votes to be able to get this bill passed, and we're asking for the Republicans to understand that this is about the racing industry in the state.
Even as he continues to threaten to slash 900 state employee jobs, Governor David Patterson tried to portray himself as the workers' champion Monday while he signed in new wage protection laws in New York. Jesse Russell reports.
A study by the National Employment Law Project said that in New York City alone, employers illegally withhold $1 billion in wages from low-wage workers per year. New York's outgoing governor, David Patterson, signed into law the Wage Theft Prevention Act, which will provide additional protections for those workers. Workers who are shortchanged by their employers can claim 100% of wages as damages in court, an increase from 25%. Employers can also see fines of $5,000 and up to 1 year in prison. The law will go into effect in 120 days. The New York Department of Labor has been one of the leading fighters for wage recovery in recent years. In 2009, the department boasted collecting a record $28.8 million in illegally withheld wages.
This newscast made possible by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get paid too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. Won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. The third decision on the lawsuits filed by the state's attorney generals across the country over the health care reform bill, which was passed earlier this year, is finally in. U.S. District Judge Henry Hudson has ruled that the Commerce Clause cannot be used to require citizens to purchase a service. So I guess it's two in favor of the bill, one against this guy. Interesting decision. We're going to talk a little bit about this because I think it's important. I've asked Elizabeth Wydra from the Constitutional Accountability Center, the usconstitution.org is their website. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
You know, were you surprised by this?
You know, I wasn't. I think that Judge Hudson had made clear from the beginning of this litigation that he was skeptical of the minimum coverage provision. And so, you know, it really wasn't a surprise. But I think it's important, as you noted, to realize that there are two other judges, including another judge in Virginia, who disagree with his view of the Commerce Clause.
Well, what do you say to the people, and I've talked to a couple folks here today, who say that, well, this is ideology, this is judicial activism, because the two who were in favor were Clinton appointees, and obviously this guy is a Bush appointee.
Well, you know, I'm hesitant to say that it is political. You know, certainly I think that people in good faith can disagree about the interpretation of the Constitution. But, you know, I think it's important to realize that Judge Hudson's ruling is a constitutional outlier, not only in terms of the rulings of the two other federal judges who have already considered the merits of the minimum coverage provision and found it constitutional, but it's also out of step with over 200 years of Supreme Court precedent on the powers of Congress, including recent precedent that has included some conservatives like Justice Scalia interpreting the Commerce Clause to allow Congress to regulate non-economic actions that have a substantial effect on interstate commerce. So I think that, you know, even conservatives have recognized that Congress has a broad power under the Commerce Clause. And so I'm pretty confident that even the conservative justices on the Supreme Court, or at least some of them, will, if the case gets that far, vote to uphold the health care reform law.
Yeah, because this is going to end up before the nine robes on the Supreme Court. And there's never been any question that in my mind that it was going to end up there. But for me, this should be a conservative issue, this issue of a personal responsibility. I don't see where the argument from the right is coming from, because you can't have free riders in any system.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And that's why I think, you know, when the administration, for example, in an editorial written by Attorney General Eric Holder and Secretary Kathleen Sebelius noted today, you know, it's an individual responsibility provision. And, you know, when people decide not to buy health insurance, you know, the Judge Hudson tries to say in his decision that that's inactivity. But, you know, it's really not. It's a profoundly economic act, and people are making an economic choice to self-insure, and it has significant financial consequences for everyone else. You know, someone pays when folks who are uninsured go to the emergency room, and it's the people who pay higher premiums for their own health insurance, because these folks have opted out of the national risk pool.
Because we're not, as a society, and I don't care what anyone says, we're not going to let people die on the street because they've made a bad choice.
No, and we absolutely shouldn't. You know, and we shouldn't also require people to buy health insurance if they can't afford it. And the law doesn't. It only requires people who can afford health insurance to purchase it or face a tax penalty. And, you know, that to me seems like just sort of, you know, responsible behavior.
I absolutely agree. You know, you're looking at this, and I look back to Social Security, I look to Medicare. We've done these big things in the past. Why now is it this big challenge? I mean, this stuff has been challenged in the past, and it's been ruled that, yeah, we can do this. It's part of the general welfare, I guess.
Right. You know, I think there are you know, the Social Security Act certainly was challenged in court when that was first passed, and, you know, the Civil Rights Act. You know, big legislation is always going to be challenged in the courts, and I think that's partly because these folks who are challenging the law lost in the political process, and now they're turning to the courts to try to get the courts to fashion a health reform law that they like better than the one that was actually passed. But the, you know, that's an argument that belongs in the political arena,
right,
and not in the court.
Well, help walk me through some of this stuff, because I've heard people make arguments on the Commerce Clause, for instance, that this either does or doesn't meet the standard of the Commerce Clause. Can you talk a bit to why you think that it does?
Yeah, so, you know, there are really two aspects of the Commerce Clause issue. Congress has the power under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution to regulate interstate commerce. And Congress also has the power under what's called the Necessary and Proper Clause to pass legislation that is necessary and proper to carrying out other powers, such as the power to regulate interstate commerce. And that Necessary and Proper Clause is important because it essentially broadens Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. So, for example, I don't think anybody would dispute that the national health care industry constitutes interstate commerce. It's, you know, will be almost 20% of our nation's economy. So the question is, if Congress has the power to regulate national healthcare industry, is it a necessary and proper tool to regulate that national industry to require folks to who can afford it to purchase insurance? And that's really the argument, that sort of healthcare reform won't really work unless we have the individual responsibility provision. And, you know, because we couldn't have the pre-existing conditions reform if we didn't require people to buy insurance,
right,
because then everyone would just wait till they got sick, you know, to get insurance. So it's that's sort of the constitutional argument. And so even if you want to characterize the decision not to buy insurance as non-economic, if it has a substantial effect on interstate commerce, then under Supreme Court precedent, clearly that would fall under Congress's constitutional authority.
Right. That's kind of the way I figured it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think if people want to look at, you know, a case on this, the 2005 case of Gonzalez versus Raich, the Supreme Court ruled that Congress, as part of its regulation of interstate commerce in illegal drugs, could prohibit a person from growing marijuana in her own backyard for personal medicinal use in a state where doing so was legal under local law. And so certainly if backyard medicinal marijuana cultivation that's never going to be sold falls under Congress's Commerce Clause power, then I can't imagine that Congress can't regulate the decision to be uninsured with its substantial financial consequences on the national health insurance market.
Excellent point. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Elizabeth Wydra. She's with the Constitutional Accountability Center, their website, theusconstitution.org. We'll put a link at our site at therickSmithShow.com. You know, one of the things that I had called for right from the beginning was a public option. First, I would have rather had Medicare for All open up the system and allow people to buy into it, and then a public option. And I was looking at the judge's decision, where he wrote, neither the Supreme Court nor the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals has extended Commerce Clause power to compel an individual to involuntarily enter the stream of commerce by purchasing a commodity in the private market. So, you know, immediately that caught my eye, and I said, well, what if it were Medicare? What if we had a public option? What if it were a public thing? Would that change his decision?
Yeah, I think ironically, you know, Judge Hudson probably, you know, his reasoning would have upheld a public option. You know, it's, but I don't think you're going to be hearing any conservatives arguing for that anytime soon.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I'm not getting the whole conservative argument against it, because I do believe in personal responsibility. And I do believe that, you know, as a member of society, you should carry your own weight and all of that stuff. Those are very, I thought, maybe I'm wrong, very conservative arguments.
Yeah, and you know, there are significant fiscal consequences of the decision to go without insurance. You know, the American taxpayers pay for state and local governments when they foot the bill for emergency care for people who don't have insurance, which, as you said before, you know, absolutely we should have, because we don't want people not to be able to get emergency care when they need it. And, you know, American people pay about $1,000 more every year for their own premiums just because they've been responsible and have purchased health insurance, and they're footing the bill for those who have opted out of the health insurance program, even though they can afford to obtain health insurance.
Right. This decision, got about a minute and a half left. This decision, this isn't going to scuttle, this doesn't scuttle the bill. This only takes the mandate portion out that wasn't supposed to be enacted till 2014, correct?
Yeah, Judge Hudson's ruling is quite narrow in that it only has to do with the minimum coverage provision, the, you know, so-called individual mandate. And, you know, it's just one of many decisions which will come on the healthcare reform law. So, you know, this isn't – there's nothing about Judge Hudson's decision that makes it any more significant than the two judges who have already ruled that the minimum coverage provision is constitutional and is legitimate and valid.
This is just us grinding our way to the inevitable, which is, you know, the Supreme Court.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, the federal courts of appeals will hear the cases before they get up to the Supreme Court. And, you know, I think that, you know, the judges who have upheld the constitutionality of the minimum coverage provision will be in the right, and Judge Hudson's decision will not be able to withstand appeal.
Do you think there's a chance that the nine robes will not hear this case? Because I know there are some cases they choose not to hear. Any chance of this being one of them?
You know, I think a lot of that depends on what the federal courts of appeals do. If the courts of appeals unanimously find that the law is constitutional, which I think they should, then the Supreme Court, they could surprise us all and just decide to let those decisions stand. But if there's disagreement among the federal circuit courts of appeals, then I think the Supreme Court will almost certainly take the case.
And what do you think the outcome will be? Because I personally look at this and I'm afraid of the five conservative justices, given the Citizens United case. They scare me.
Well,
I don't want to put anything in their hands.
Well, Citizens United scares me too. But I just do not see five votes on the Supreme Court for striking down the health care reform law. Supreme Court precedent on the Commerce Clause power is pretty clear. And while it hasn't dealt with this particular subject matter before, of course, I think that, you know, you could easily get to a majority of five justices for finding it constitutional, you know, either through Justice Kennedy joining with the four more liberal justices on the court, or, you know, Chief Justice Roberts, who, you know, has claimed to be a judicial minimalist, and, you know, I think we are still waiting for some of that.
I'm waiting for that.
Maybe this will be the case.
Yeah, he was the umpire of the game that I lost.
That's right, yeah.
Elizabeth Wydry, I appreciate your time. From the Constitutional Accountability Center, their website, theusconstitution.org. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of a lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm on till 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Yeah, get it started, man. Love this song. I actually like her. She very, very, very nice. Nice. Actually, she does in the video. She does have purple hair. Thank you very much.
That's your weakness.
There you go. No, Michelle Bachmann is my weakness. That's my Achilles.
Well, you know,
that's my Achilles.
Rick, shame on you. You not only like kinky, you like dumb.
Well, hey. Nothing wrong with that. It's good for a weekend. And I married the complete opposite. I married someone smarter than me.
Yes, you did.
Married someone smarter than me, better looking than me, and saner than I am.
You hit the lottery.
Yes, I did. Our Borowitz report from Andy Borowitz. Just when Haiti thought it had suffered every disaster imaginable, former quitter Alaska Governor Sarah Palin decided to visit. In the disaster-torn nation's capital, a leading government minister warned citizens to prepare for the worst. We've suffered through earthquakes, flooding, and disease, said Minister of Disaster Jean-Claude Manzare. But it remains to be seen whether we can withstand a disaster of Sarah Palin's magnitude. Across Hades, the civilian population prepared themselves for the possible devastation Palin might cause, especially to their language and syntax. The minister went on to say, "We have seen what she has done to English and fear that she could do the same to French." Upon her arrival, Governor Palin, the quitter that she is, seemed to get off on the wrong foot by repeatedly announcing the name Haiti. Minister Monseret said that he and his countrymen were fearing the worst but hoping for the best. "Our only hope," he says, "is that she does what she did in Alaska. Leave early."
But before she left, she issued a statement and proceeded to tell the rest of the world leaders what they should do, since she has this vast experience in Haiti's problems.
Yeah.
All 30 minutes worth.
Unbelievable. Anyway, she showed up with Franklin Graham, who's one of these, you know, these way out right wing religious types, the type that, you know, they put themselves in the middle of all these disasters. And the first thing they do is they put a bowl of food in front of these starving people with one hand, and then they take that book of theirs and they pound them over the head before they're allowed to have the food. And that's my big problem with a lot of these religious groups. It's my problem with a lot of these religious groups, period, is that they've got to go out there and they've got to preach their mission statement instead of doing what they should be doing, which is just feeding people. Why does one always have to come with the other? Why can't you just do the right thing? And, you know, here again, you know, Sarah Palin trying to cozy up to those folks. And, you know, understand, this was nothing more than a photo op. This was nothing more than her getting her name out to that, doing that dog whisper politicking that she's famous for, hitting the buzzwords so that Graham's people would hear it. You know, she was out there testifying. Always love that, which generally means you're annoying somebody. But yeah, that's kind of how this went. And what I find interesting is the group that Graham runs, and this is what the UK journal, what the UK, the Guardian in the UK wrote. And this is what gets me. They wrote Samantha's Purse, which is Graham's charitable group, has been accused during other humanitarian crises of putting its evangelical mission ahead of more tangible assistance to those in need. The organization raises large sums of money from U.S. Christians, but the proceeds are not always visible on the ground. Like I said, they're pocketing a big bunch of it. During the 1994 Rwanda refugee crisis, Samantha's Purse was criticized by other aid organizations for spending large amounts on luxury accommodations for its staff and providing only minimal assistance as tens of thousands of people died of cholera. The assistance principally consisted of sending stretcher bearers to carry the sick for treatment. As a third person, and this just irks me to death. They got two people carrying these six folks to treatment or to the doctors or whatever, and you got a third person there reading the Bible to them. I mean, just carry, you know, you could have had two more people carrying folks and just doing the work, but no, you got to screw with them. In 2001, Samantha's Purse was scorned for requiring victims of El Salvador's earthquake to attend prayer meetings before they could receive aid. And I think that's my point. I really don't even need to go into much more of it. I think the UK writer did a pretty good job of it right there. And that's always been my position, Jake. You know that. Right there. On the day, you're going to love this. And this is kind of how I think that that all politicians, these are the kind of politicians we need to have, I think. Senator Mark Kirk, Republican from Illinois. He's only been in office a little time, a couple of weeks, I guess. Already, he's helping lead the Republican charge to protect the tax cuts for the wealthy. But days after he was sworn in, he decided that the best thing to do would be to, ask his constituents to email him what he should do. What should I do? Would you send me a text? Email me. Tell me what I should do. And, you know, it's a nice gesture to say, oh, I want to do the work of my constituents. Honestly, I don't think he knew. I don't think he had been told yet he was that new into office. Maybe he couldn't find his office yet, but he was actually asking for direction. And I wonder, you know, if we had all of those politicians doing that kind of stuff. I look at the folks in Ohio and in Wisconsin. I'm sure the residents of those two states wish their idiot savants, who will soon be sitting in the governor's mansions, would ask for their input. Or they wouldn't have turned down the, $1.2 billion in stimulus funding to build a high-speed rail. And, you know, I look at this and I go, you know, at some point, folks, these people are going to harm us in the worst of possible ways. And this, I look at what Ohio and Wisconsin are in deep need of jobs. These two were elected because there was no job growth. They were a stagnant economy. So what's the first thing they do? They come in and they bite the hand that was going to send them 80,000 jobs. Because, well, we don't need no stinking train. The train is dead. And they're proud of their anti-innovation, their anti-vision stances. And the sad thing is, other states around the country took that, and they're going to invest in their states. Now, how is this going to hurt Ohio and Wisconsin? If you've got a 21st century rail system in a state where you're going to use that for your employees to get back and forth to work, where you're going to use that to get your products to market, where you're going to use that as a sales pitch for other people to come into that area, Ohio and Wisconsin lose out just because they had to, you know, they voted for these guys who sold them a beautiful story. It's a beautiful story. I mean, Kasich, the guy in Ohio, my dad was a postal worker. He was a good union man. So you got a bunch of union people who ran out and voted for him because his dad was a union guy. Like Toomey. How many times you hear Toomey say, my dad was a union guy? You know, he worked hard. Yet both of these two, they will do everything they can do to destroy the unions, to destroy what they benefited from. Explain to me how that works. I mean, because I'm not getting it. I'm really just not. And the further we move away from people understanding that it was their father's or their grandfather's involvement in their union who fought for better wages, hours, and conditions that made their lives better, I fear what the future holds on the very short term. I know what the long term consequences are. Eventually, we're going to just relive history and go through all this all over again. But on the short term, you know,
Well, you wonder where people's heads were. I know in 2000 and 2004 that Ohio was critical to the presidential. I also realized that Ohio, if there's any one state that has been harder hit since the year 2000, Pennsylvania, it's probably Ohio. I mean, Pennsylvania's been heavily hit. We lost 70% of our industrial base in 10 years. But Ohio was darn near a basket case. And finally, in 2008, they voted for Obama. But in 2 years, you're not going to be able to change everything in that state. And apparently, Ohio is just indicative of what happened across the country because of anger and because not really understanding what was happening and taking out their frustration. They've really regressed.
Yep. And Wisconsin as well.
And that's exactly what we've been pushing on the show. And labor unions and progressives have been saying, look, we've got to reinvest in our economy. And you said, look, you talk about a multiplier. You're not only creating jobs. You're not only creating jobs who then can take the money that they earn and reinvest in their communities. You're setting up an infrastructure that makes it appealing to other companies coming into the state.
Well, and to make that point. Wisconsin, who is, they're in trouble. They need employers. Because of this decision, and you go, well, Rick, you know, how do you know jobs would come? How do you know they're going to lose jobs? Well, they've just lost a bunch of jobs here. Talgo Incorporated, the Spanish manufacturer of high-speed train cars, they have abandoned their plant in Milwaukee. They're going to be gone in 2012. That's gone. All gone. A spokesman for the company said, you know, we can't stay and manufacture in Milwaukee without the high-speed train rail to Madison. This is terrible news. So they're closing down shop. They're leaving. They're going to go somewhere else and build their train somewhere else. The jobs will go somewhere else. And, you know, they're saying, look, you know, this sends a terrible message for people considering to locate in the state. This is a business spokesperson saying, look, by not investing in your infrastructure, you're sending a message to the people who might want to come here that you're not a place that, wants to do business. Now, look, I'm one who says we don't need to be business-friendly tax-wise. I think we're business-friendly enough. I think deregulation is just the worst thing in the world. We're too business-friendly in that vein. But where you are to be business-friendly is you build an infrastructure where you build the field where corporations can compete. You build an education system that will, train the next generation of, smart people to work in these places. That's how you become more business friendly. Not who has the lowest taxes, not who's willing to give out the biggest handouts. And when we come back, we'll talk about one of those handouts. Because again, you know, the more money we hand out to corporations, the more money we hand out in the form of so-called tax cuts, the less money we have to educate our children, the less money we have to take care of our citizens. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about those big handouts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
One thing is clear from November's election results. Those new tea-infused Republican lawmakers are going to end business as usual in Congress. As incoming Senator Rand Paul so plainly put it, we've come to take our government back. Ah, yes, a government of the people, at last. But as one corporate lobbyist said of the fresh-faced newcomers, as soon as they get here, we need to co-opt them. Well, that didn't take long. Just days after their election, even before they had been assigned office space in the Capitol, dozens of these so-called citizen legislators were holding lobbyist-sponsored fundraisers at various swank watering holes around Washington. They glad-handed and grinned as such special interests as ExxonMobil, Delta Airlines, and Wall Street bankers welcomed them by slipping thousands of dollars into each of their pockets. Adam Kinzinger of Illinois was one. Back home, he was pledging to change Washington. Only 2 weeks after winning a House seat, however, Washington was changing him. He held a debt retirement breakfast at the Capitol Hill Club, gleefully greeting corporate influence peddlers who paid up to $5,000 each to curry favor with him. Exchanging winks, the lobbyist knew that business as usual was alive and well. And there's Andy Harris of Maryland, a doctor who won a House seat on November 4th by denouncing Obamacare as socialized medicine. But 6 days later, Andy was in Washington asking, "Where's mine?" At a briefing for newcomers, Harris was incredulous to learn that the socialized health coverage that Congress critters get wouldn't kick in until 4 weeks after he took the oath of office. This is Jim Hightower saying, tell me again how this bunch is so different? They're not even in office yet, and they're already playing the insider game like old pros.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, starting this Saturday, mark it on your calendars. Do whatever it is you got to do. Put it in your BlackBerry. Write it on your hand like Sarah Palin. Whatever you got to do. But this Saturday, December 18th, we're going to be at the Giant in Carlisle, 255 South Spring Garden Street, beginning our Hungry and Homeless for the Holidays event. We're hoping that you'll come out and, say hello. And while you're doing that, bring us a couple of canned goods, some non-perishable items to be donated to Project Share, and maybe a couple of bucks thrown into the till as well to help out Carlisle Cares and Project Share in the new year. you know, talking about infrastructure, talking about, you know, investing in your state. A lot of people think that what we need to be doing is we need to be, oh, I don't know, like Mitzi Romney, giving all these corporations all this money. We should have economic development money just flowing out of our, well, it should be flowing. And we should be just giving it to these corporations, again, in the hopes that they'll create jobs. And as I've said a number of times, we can give them all kinds of money. Doesn't mean they're going to create jobs. What they need customers. So instead of giving them the money, we should buy stuff from them so that they'll hire people to meet our demand. But that's too logical for most folks in the Republican Party and a lot of Democrats, too, which is why we keep hearing it, man. These big companies getting huge paydays by moving to one state or another. And I think of, you know, Carlisle Tire and Wheel. They got somewhere in the $30 to $40 million range to leave the city of Carlisle to head for Tennessee because they got a nice payday.
Well, exactly what you're talking about. There's a story coming out of Kentucky. Part of it's good and part of it maybe not so good when you look at the big picture. Ford has decided to invest about $600 million in reformulating an assembly plant in Louisville. And what they're going to be doing is going to be retrofitting that plant where they used to produce Ford trucks. They're going to be producing the Ford Escape.
Good.
Where it used to employ 1,100, eventually it will employ 2,900. They will be bringing in laid-off auto workers from the area. They will also be bringing in workers from other shuttered plants. Now, that's a good thing. The unemployment rate in that area was about 9.4, so they probably won't have a hard time finding workers. The downside is that the state of Kentucky is giving him a nice fat check of about $240 million.
That must be the same money that they offered to Harley Davidson.
And you thought that it very well might be. Well, I'm sure it's out of the same pool. Is it the same money that they were going to allocate? But that could very well be possible.
You know, what's interesting about that is, you know, you go through that and you realize that states like Kentucky, states like Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, the ones that are screaming about the federal government taking money from them, they're the ones that generally get more back than they send. You know, like Pennsylvania, for instance, for every dollar we send to Washington, we get about 94 cents, I think, back. So we actually lose 6 cents on a dollar. Now, that 6 cents goes somewhere, generally to one of the states I mentioned. You look at Massachusetts. For every dollar it sends, it gets about 82 cents back. So those are the states that you think, one would think those would be the states that would be screaming, and the New Mexicos who get like $2.30 for every dollar they send, you'd think that they'd be going, hey, oh, no, things are going great just the way they are. Keep those dollars coming our way. And what bothers me is, look at the state of Tennessee, $30 million to Carlisle Tire and Wheel to move the plant. We gave them the money. That's the part that drives me nuts. We're the ones who are saying, here's a boatload of money. Divvy it up. Give it to the southern states. Give it to the other states. And they're using the money that we're giving them against us. It's the same thing that with this wealth tax cut. We're giving all of this money to the top 1%, to the very wealthy people in this country. And what are they doing? They're taking the money and they're using it against us. That's really the sickest part of all this. And we're in the street. Let's do it. Yeah. I mean, it's just, are we that dense? I mean, really, I don't know. You know, and I look at this guy from Alabama. Spencer Baucus, his name is, representative of the 6th congressional district there in Alabama. He is going to be the, and I cannot believe this, he's going to be the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. He's going to be the guy. He's going to be overseeing the banks. You're going to love his philosophy. He believes, and this is, he was interviewed on Wednesday about, you know, his, he says, quote, in Washington, the view is that the banks are to be regulated. And my view, he says, is that Washington And the regulators are there to serve the banks. Think about that for a second. The guy whose job it is to oversee the banking industry, his belief is that his job and that of the regulators are to serve the banks, not oversee their operations. Give them what they need, whatever you need. Isn't that how we got into this mess? I mean, really, honestly, and truthfully, I know we didn't learn the lessons from the Depression. You know, I remember the whole Graham Leach Bliley thing. I remember that whole push under the Clinton administration to pass that Economic Modernization Act of 1999. I remember that. And they told us, oh, the banks learned. They would never take the risks that they took in the past. They would never do the things that got us into trouble. Oh, no, trust them. Trust them. It only took them really 6 years to crash our entire economy. I mean, 8 is when the collapse happened, but it was the first 6, they got us. And it was all just pushing, you know, getting water out of the boat because we knew the collapse was coming. I called the collapse, you know, years before it happened. Only I called it for the spring of 2009 because I thought the Bush administration would be able to prop up the economy by deficit spending enough to push it off onto Obama or whoever was next. I really thought that was going to happen. It was so bad that they could not stop the collapse. That's the amazing thing to me. And you've got this guy now who's going to be the head. He's the chief dog in charge, thinking that his job is to serve the banking industry, not oversee it, not regulate it, not restrain or control or make sure that it stays within boundaries. It's not his job. His job is to say, whatever you need, Mr. Banker. You want those derivatives? You want those mortgage-backed securities? You want those big chocolate turds? Here you go.
I guess he missed the point, the simple point, that he was elected to serve the interest of the people he represents. Simple, but very profound.
Now, you want to know about his career? 18 years he's been representing the 6th District there in Alabama. 18 years. His campaigns have raised millions from the financial sectors, including $1 million from commercial banks, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. Over $1 million from commercial banks alone he's raised. He's also received $800,000 from the real estate industry, $700,000 from the securities investment firms, and another $415,000 from credit card companies. He is now the guy. He's the guy sitting on that, heading that committee. Doesn't that scare you? It scares me.
Come on. Let's give the corporate interest credit. They know where to put the honey, so to speak.
My view is that Washington and the regulators are there to serve the banks.
And once again, it all comes down to money.
And we voluntarily put these twits into power. Oh man, we are in for such a screwing that I don't really think we're gonna really understand it until it's all over.
And the sad part about it, without even knowing the numbers, and I'll bet you he's a pretty safe. But even if, let's say
he's
the numbers
safe.
Are fairly close.
Very safe.
But even if the numbers were fairly close, given the fact that he's been there a long time, given the fact that the huge amounts of money he can raise. And given the fact that pretty much incumbents are encased incumbent protection system, it would be very hard unless he does something, unless he violates the law, Rick, or unless he retires, that you would ever get him out of there. And isn't that sad for democracy?
It is really, really sad. And I got to be honest with you. There's part of me that goes, you know what? We deserve whatever it is we're going to get.
And you know what? The longer he's there, the easier it is to justify doing things that are questionable.
Yep. Amazing.
Ask Charlie Rangel.
Another one. Let's go to the phones. We got Mike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Mike?
Pretty good, Rick. Hey, what wait till we kind of heard about what was happening with, you know, this whole tax debacle that they got going on in Washington before we sent you some numbers. We ran some math, and we integrated based on numbers that we're seeing historically about what the economy's doing and where our debt figures are sitting. What we did is we came up with a mathematical model of what the economy's going to look like in, you know, basically this time, 2015. And what we came up with was we're going to increase our national debt to $24.25 trillion in the next 5 years.
And what percentage of our GDP will that be?
At that point, let's see, where did we put GDP? Actually, that's, well, we put GDP at $16.97 trillion for 2015. So that puts us, do the math, 150%.
Worse than after World War II.
Yeah.
That would be the worst in the history of the country then.
Well, and here's the deal, too, is that, you know, the budget deficit, it is going to drop down to a little over $1 trillion, and government spending is going to drop a little bit, too, but it's the interest that we're paying on this debt that's crushing us, and it's our unfunded liabilities. The unfunded liabilities, which you guys know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, that whole thing, is going to jump to $144 trillion in 2015. I mean, we checked these numbers 3 times, and everything was right spot on. And all we had to do was we said, for this model to work, the government needs to keep doing what they're doing right now. So, in other words, the Bush tax cuts, we wanted those to go through because for our model to work, those had to go through. The government had to keep doing exactly what it was doing right now. And, you know, here it is.
So you're in favor of the Bush tax cuts going through?
Oh, absolutely not. Are you kidding me?
Oh, I'm missing that one.
No. Before I could give you this information, we had to see those tax cuts go through.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, it would have thrown our model off.
All right. So thankfully, for your model, the Republicans stood their ground and got the tax cuts for the wealthy. Okay.
Yeah. So guess what? Here, it's a mathematical issue. What's happening is we're seeing an exponential loss here. I mean, we're seeing growth in debt that is just going to blow off the scale. And, you know, like you just said, that, you know, they couldn't control bank implosion. They just couldn't do it. There was no way to cover it up. Well, guess what? We're going to have the same issues come up here. But it's going to be the entire economy. It's not just going to be the banks.
Right. I have a banker friend who says that wait till this spring. The mortgage bubble is going to pop again.
Well, the other thing that we did, too, is we looked at the unemployment rate, and the unemployment rate is going to jump to 15.45%.
Wow.
So, you know, we've got some really tough years ahead of us, and we really need to just stop and just say, okay, listen, this sucks. We can't sustain this. We really got to think, okay, what is the legacy we want to leave for future generations? Or are we even going to have future generations? Because at the rate we're going, we're not going to. And I'm going to leave you with this one before I hang up, that we ran the model out to 2030.9, essentially where we ran it to.
September, okay.
Okay, and what happens is our budget deficit finally is in the black. We have a $19 billion budget deficit, but check this out. Our total assets, the country's assets, we are now in the red. We don't own anything. We have basically sold off all the assets the country has by that time. And our national debt is almost $56 trillion.
Oh, my gosh.
And this is simple math. Okay?
I guess if you don't own anything, why does it matter if you're in debt? What can they take? What else can they take?
Well, the reason we ran it out there was because we were like, okay, well, this is about when we're going to retire, so let's see where the economy's at when we're going to retire. We all kind of giggled at one another. We were like, what economy? What country? You know, it's done by that point. You know, so we need to do something in the next 5 years because I think that there's a chance that, you know, if we do some serious, you know, we came up with a median tax rate of 47.6%. that we need to establish now.
A median tax rate.
A median tax rate of 47.6%. This is what needs to happen right now for this exponential curve to flatten out. If we don't do it, it's all over. It's just a matter of time. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And you want to talk about a national security issue, this is the national security issue.
No, I'm absolutely right there with you. I mean, the fact that we're paying $200 billion a year on the Reagan debt should scare people.
Well, I didn't know that when I heard you say that, and I almost choked. I said, that's unbelievable.
That's just the Reagan debt, and most people I know weren't even alive during the Reagan years.
No, and I was barely a teenager at that point, too, so I had no clue what was going on. I knew Reagan was a president, but I had no clue what was going on economically then, and to hear that we're paying $200 billion a year on debt that was accrued 30 years ago?
Yep.
Ugh.
And that's what my kids are going to say in 20 years. What, I'm paying on the Bush debt?
Yep. Well, it's not. If there's even something for them to do, you know, I mean, the rate we're going, man, things are just not looking good for the home team right now.
Well, that's why we got to get active and involved right now. That's why we can't sit on the sidelines for 2 years and hope and pray. Mike, I appreciate the call. Always great information.
All right, buddy. See ya. Yeah,
thanks so much. No, I right there, man. Wow. Those are huge, huge numbers. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back to wrap things up. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have a bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, hungryandhomeless.org. If you got a couple of bucks you want to donate to the local food bank, that'd be a great thing to do. All deductions, all contributions tax deductible. So that'd be nice on April 15th. Help out the community and, you know, get a little bit back at the end of the year. A couple of quick stories. Kentucky State Senate Republicans said they will introduce legislation similar to the Arizona law that allows local police to enforce federal immigration law. Republican Senate President David Williams, who, of course, plans to run for governor in the spring. Wonder how, think about that. Announced plans on Friday after the state Republican caucus met to hash out their legislative agenda. And I'm sure here in Pennsylvania, if Metcalf could come around and get some traction with his craziness, we might see something like that here. Personally, I think here in Pennsylvania, we're not going to see that kind of insanity. What I think we're going to see here are corporations seeing an opportunity to really cash in. Because if you look at the people that Corbett has sought for his transition team, the people that he wants in his cabinet, they're all kind of Ridge, they're all Ridge, former Ridge people first, but they're all corporatists. They're all the big corporate people. They see now the opportunity to get rid of all the regulation, get rid of the taxes, get rid of, anything that would help the community. Benefit them, of course, not you and I. And the biggest one that I fear is making Pennsylvania a right-to-work state. That would be a major devastation for this state, an absolutely devastating effect. Speaking of Kentucky, it appears that Rand Paul and his father will be roomies when Rand comes to Washington next month, sharing the Elder's Virginia condo. Ron said, I told him as long as he doesn't expect me to cook, he can come. He says, I'm not going to take care of him the way his mother did. And I hope, for your sake, Ron, that he doesn't treat you like the woman that he tied up and took down to the river and made her worship the Aqua Buddha.
No, I mean, actually, Ron Paul, in some issues, we agree with him.
Yeah, I mean, this WikiLeaks thing is one of them.
But his son is an absolute... I don't know the best way to describe him. An aberration? Is that the right word? I don't know. He's got some strange ideas about our republic. That's all I can say.
It is what it is, I guess, One of those things. But yeah, with the old man, I gotta be honest. I agree with him on the WikiLeaks thing, which I gotta be honest, I think is the issue of our time.
Well, you probably agree with him on the wars, too.
I absolutely agree with him on the wars. We should never gotten into him to begin with. But then again, that is the libertarian part of me. My problem is then it goes too far.
Well, and you got to admire the man on one level. He's consistent within his own philosophy, and he doesn't veer to his son. I mean, his son is all over the map. Wow. He's not the kind of man we need in Congress. That's all I got to say. Talking about his son.
It'll be interesting to watch. It'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah, well,
I always loved a good train wreck.
I used to watch The Big Top. I used to, when I was young. I saw enough circuses. I don't need the Congress of the United States turning into one.
You never know. Afghanistan President Hamid Karzai has reportedly told the U.S.'s top two officials in his country, that would be General David Petraeus and Ambassador Carl Eikenberry, that America is one of his three main enemies. He said, if I had to choose sides today, I'd choose the Taliban. And yeah, we're still propping this guy up. So kudos to us for spending the blood of our soldiers and the wealth of our treasure for someone like that. Because it's not about terrorism anymore. Has nothing to do. There are no terrorists in Afghanistan. There's nothing in Afghanistan. They're in Pakistan. But that's one of those things. Anyway, I want to thank everybody for being here tonight, especially Brett, our guy who slides the tubes and the knobs. If you missed any part of the program, go to therickssmithshow.com. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lure of sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
They're stealing down on Wall Street and in Washington, too. You know, it makes me wonder, what's a guy on Main Street to do? I've always tried to be an honest, upstanding.